You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week my friend Sam Husseini. He is the communications director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, whom I have to thank for having found and promoted many of my previous guests on this program. Husseini wrote an article titled "Catherine Gunn's Risky Truth-Telling," which you should read. It is about a British official, you may remember, who crucially leaked evidence of NSA spying against UN officials during the buildup to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. The Intercept has now published copies of the NSA's internal newsletter that fit into this story. Sam Husseini, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Great to be with you, David.
Great to hear your voice. And for those who never heard it or have forgotten since 2003 or so, who was Catherine Gunn? What did she do? What did she tell us?
She was a translator for the GCHQ, which is the British equivalent of the NSA. She translated it, you know, into Mandarin Chinese. And she got a memo in early 2003, before the invasion of Iraq, from an official at the NSA saying, "Hey, everybody, we at the NSA and our partners like you are spiking up our surveillance of Security Council members, including at the UN. So please, let's have a surge of activity that we can use to gain a position of advantage," I think is the term that he used, in order to have a positive outcome regarding the deliberations at the UN. And what he was basically saying was, let's get information that we can use to coerce other members of the Security Council so that we can pressure them into going along with the Iraq war.
That is for purposes of blackmail or just for purposes of threats and bribes? Or we don't
know. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it could be anything from, "Hey, buddy, we know that you're having an affair. Wouldn't it be a shame if your wife found out about it?" To, "Oh, hey, this country is trying to make a move to get all these other countries to not go along with our resolution. How do we cut them off at the knees?" I mean, it could be a whole variety of things.
There were always suspicions, Sam, that the NSA and the Bush White House was doing the same to Congress members, but we never had a whistleblower really give that to us, did we?
No, not to my knowledge. That's a very good point. And this is very rare. I mean, you know, people should understand what a whistleblower means. It's, you know, somebody on the inside who's on the payroll, who's on their team, decides that they can't take any more. And they're going to blow the whistle.
But Catherine Gunn, before this, she saw this memo, didn't realize that her government or the U.S. government was spying on other governments' diplomats and then using that information for pressure. She wasn't aware of that and considered it immoral and illegal?
I don't know how much she was aware of it. She dealt with the Chinese primarily, and this was a particularly onerous activity. I mean, the line from the NSA and from the U.S. government is, "We're spying for your protection to get the terrorists."
Right.
Here, it's a totally brazen. They are spying at the UN, which is illegal. That violates treaties, and they're doing it in order to ram through a war, which I think it's fairly, you know, a fair amount of people thought it was fairly clear that it was an aggressive war, which means that it's illegal, and that it would destabilize, and as we've seen in the intervening years, threaten publics in Britain and the U.S. and so on.
So what did Catherine Gunn do when she saw this thing?
She leaked it. I believe it went through some activists in England, actually. I don't know all of the details, but it ended up at the British Observer, a newspaper there. They published it, and it made headlines all around the world, especially in the countries that were on the Security Council at the time. And there was no resolution. There was no second UN resolution, giving the okay for the U.S. invasion. The U.S. had gotten one resolution in November of 2002, and John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, said that there would be a second resolution. He said this is a two-step process.
And George W. Bush said that,
He may well have. Probably right.
But that first resolution didn't, authorize a war. I mean, this was why they wanted a second one, a different one that it actually would authorize a war, right?
Exactly. And people might remember, the war didn't began by George W. Bush saying, Saddam, you got 48 hours to, clear yourself and your family out of Baghdad. And then they actually put out a statement saying even if he did clear out of Baghdad, we'd still invade.
Yeah, because the president...
So it had nothing to do in the end with the pretext of WMDs and all of this.
The president of Spain later told newspapers that he'd met with Bush, and Bush had told him that Hussein had offered to leave the country if he could keep $1 billion, and that Bush, of course, was, not going to go for that. If that was true, the possibility of having Saddam Hussein leave for a much lesser expense than what the war cost was sitting on the table, right?
Right.
So no wonder he said, even if you do leave, we're bombing you anyway.
Right. And I assume that story is true. If it is true, that's just an opening gambit from Saddam. They could have got, I'm sure they could have gotten him down to, okay, you'll leave and we won't kill you.
Right, or 300,000. In any case, what's $1 billion compared to the trillions in a nation destroyed? I know Catherine Gunn I've communicated with her a little bit, and I've watched videos of her speaking at panels, and I know that she's totally against war, at least now, and presumably was even then. Was her motivation to prevent the war? It seems like most whistleblowers blow the whistle when it doesn't matter anymore, when it's sort of for the historians. She's like actually the rare example of that model whistleblower who acted when it mattered, when it could have made a difference, and did make a difference in terms of making the war have to be illegal.
Right. Yeah. And Ellsberg's called this the most important leak of all time.
Really.
And it's incredibly short. In this age of WikiLeaks and The Intercept putting out these massive databases and everything, it's 300 words. The power of it was in its timeliness, that it blew the whistle on illegal activities before the war started, and it could have really tripped them up. The British Observer reporter got booked on all of these U.S. shows, the TV shows, and got canceled at the last minute. That indicates that...
By the White House, presumably?
Or? Yeah, that indicates that a memo went out, that something went out saying, you can't have this guy on, or you need to really think twice about having this guy on at this point. That story got virtually blacked out in the U.S. media. We at the Institute for Public Accuracy, we put out a whole series of news releases on it, but virtually no coverage in the U.S. at the time.
So this should have been in the news back then, and it's in the news now, or in a better world, should be in the news now, because some documents have been published by The Intercept. What are those, and what do they add to the story?
They published, and the New York Times reported on some of them. They're basically they're the internal newsletter of the NSA. And it's what they published, or part of what they published so far, is them basically high-fiving each other because John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, lauded their work, for spying at the UN in helping him, push the case for war. What's being published now is their internal, yay, we're so great, we helped the U.S. ambassador push the Iraq war onto the world, or try to.
Yeah.
It was very subtle, but the Intercept actually made some mistakes in some of its reporting on this. For example, they claimed they referred to UN resolutions at the time, and there were no UN resolutions at the time. As we've just said, there was only one. There were resolutions after the war started. But before the war, in the intervening period, you know, let's say the 6 months prior, there was only one resolution, and that's part of the point. Catherine Gunn's blowing the whistle was a significant factor, if not a determining factor, in preventing a second UN resolution that would have given international cover to this war.
Yeah. Sam Husseini, Communications Director at IPA, Institute for Public Accuracy. I wonder how much credit you give Catherine Gunn's leak in terms of preventing the UN and its national components from supporting the legalization of the war, and how much credit, if any, you give to what in today's terms was a huge peace movement around the world and in the United States, the single biggest day of street protest action in world history on February 15th, 03, and so forth, and whether the two fed into each other at all. Was Catherine...
You might have had more communication with her than I did, but I never asked her directly. But the timeline of, I believe that she leaked the document shortly after the February 15th global protests.
Right.
So they may well have inspired her to act. You know, seeing this groundswell of support. I mean, there were a million people on the streets of New York. There were a million people. I think 2 million on the streets of London, in Rome, and so on and so forth. So I believe that you know what you're inferring here is that they went hand in hand. I mean, what you said before, I think it's right, David. That it's always a chicken and egg thing about a whistleblower, because if they're on the inside, you know, they probably had some activity. I mean, Gunn is a little unique in that she's fairly young. You know, I think when all of this happened, she was 28.
Right, right. Most whistleblowers, right. You're asking, well, now, what about those 36 wars that you sat through and then you resigned for this one?
Right.
You know, you're trying to figure that out in your mind.
Right.
With her, she didn't go through too many. Like, she didn't, she wasn't part of that many wars before this. What sliver of the U.S. public knows anything about this story?
Yeah, no, I mean, very little. And, what's remarkable about it is that even in the community that follows leaks and so on, this case is very rarely acknowledged, even though it is such an emblematic case of the potential power of whistleblowing. And it's just understandable. You know, it's a short document, it has never significantly gotten out. I mean, there was reporting they tried to prosecute her under the British Official Secrets Act,
right?
Like in 2004 or something like that, they didn't. They backed off. I think that they feared a trial. Because of what would come out in terms of what they knew and didn't know in the course of things.
What about accountability on the side where it's actually merited on the NSA and those involved? Has there been any sort of consequence to them?
No. There's been absolutely no consequence to them, and, of course, not to the general war makers. I mean, virtually everybody who went along with the war, whether it's Kerry or Clinton, and of course the Bush administration themselves, has falsified, their own records in terms of why, what they did, when they did, why they did it, to the extent that they've been scrutinized at all.
Right.
Kerry said that, I voted for Bush to have authorization, and the moment that he misused it, I objected. That's just a total lie.
Yeah.
Kerry didn't say anything when Bush went into Iraq, except late that year he started saying that Bush might, he was afraid that Bush would cut and run. Right. He wasn't pursuing the war fervently enough.
He was against the war in the same way that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were against the war. Not at all.
Yeah. I mean, Trump's, got who the hell knows about Trump.
Go back and watch the videos. At the time, he was in favor of the war. Now he says he was against the war.
Right. Which isn't terribly dissimilar. You're right. It's not dissimilar from Kerry and Clinton and so on.
Except that
Bush, for that matter. Bush, a couple of years ago when questioned, said, if only Saddam had cooperated with the weapons inspectors. Again, just totally falsifying how the war actually started.
Yes.
Iraq was cooperating.
Of course, and offering total inspection of the entire country by the U.S. military, and no, right. We want a war. War would be better. You're moving to the topic of elections, and I know you wanted to mention this project that you're working on called Vote Pact, which you've proposed to, as I understand it, not tremendous success in a number of election cycles now. What is the idea of Vote Pact?
Sure. It's basically based on the observation that you have a lot of people who feel like they say in this election, I don't want Clinton, but I feel like I got to vote for her because I really don't want Trump. And a lot of people on the other side of that saying, I don't want Trump, but I totally despise Clinton, so I'm going to have to suck it up and vote for Trump. Now, a lot of people, of course, have broken free of the system. They've said, no, they're both distasteful. They're both, I don't want either of them, so I'm going to vote for the, independent or third-party candidate that I most believe in, whether it's Green or Libertarian or Peace and Freedom or whatever.
Right.
This is for the people who might not be there quite yet, and what it allows is for, if you know somebody, know and trust somebody, a relative, a coworker, a debating partner, whatever, on the other side of the two-party divide, then you both vote for the third parties of your choice. That way you're siphoning off votes in pairs from Clinton and Trump. It has the potential to, shoot up, kind of exponentially, because if people start doing this, then third-party candidates start registering on the polls, which themselves are skewed. We can get into that too. Then it builds up. It's a winning strategy. A lot of strategies, like vote swapping, which says a swing voter in a swing state to swap votes with a voter in a so-called safe state, that kind of thing. None of those aren't winning strategies. Those are strategies that attempt to mitigate the quote-unquote damage of third-party run.
But Annie, I guess one explanation for why it hasn't taken off is, the same reason that nobody knows about Katherine Gunn. You and I don't own a television network, you have to have a massive communication system to repeat something over and over again to get the American public to hear it. But I would suspect that it also hasn't taken off because most supporters of political candidates for office, especially the U.S. president, are nowhere near that rational. And once they start supporting someone, even if they sort of think of it as lesser evilism, they start blanking out any news about their faults and start exaggerating their positive aspects and become sort of cheerleaders for their positions, which lasts, throughout the year, beyond the election. They become cheerleaders for one party or the other at the expense of reality and facts, and rationality is out the window. And once you start to introduce rationality, then it gets really complicated, because what if my friend on the other side of the divide is in a swing state where it might matter and I'm not, is it a fair trade? And what if I've reached the point where I'm ready to say, you know, lesser evilism is giving us a more evil pair each and every time. This is not sustainable. It's gone too far already. And I see both of these characters as exactly equally evil. I could never vote for Hillary or Trump. Then I'm not in a position where I can imagine myself in either the Hillary or the Trump camp in order to make a trade with the other side, because I could never stand to put myself in either of those camps.
Yeah, look, if somebody has reached that point, then they don't need Vote Pact. They can tell other people about it who are, you know, nagging them about how can you vote for a third party when it might help that, you know, Trump win? Come on. Mm-hmm. Then you can say, well, no, I'm free and you can be too if you use this thing.
Yeah.
I think you do have a point about there could be unequal trades. You know, a vote in Ohio is not equal necessarily to a vote in New York in our system.
Right.
So it does work best if people do it in the same state. But that's a relatively easy thing to do, because people tend to, not always certainly, tend to be in the same state as somebody they know and trust and, talk about these things.
But most people don't talk about the election. They avoid it. It's like a topic that if you bring up, somebody's going to scream at you. So there could be people who silently are willing to do Vote Pact. Oh, that's a nice idea. My brother and I will do that. He won't vote for Hillary. I won't vote for Trump. We'll both go vote for decent people in our view of things. But they would never put their names on a website and say, hey, we're part of this growing trend of Vote Pact, because they don't want to, be public about something that's so toxic in our conversation.
I don't know. It's my fear that people, don't bring up this kind of what I would consider real strategic voting with their political opposite number, because they're so used to avoiding even talking about it with their brother.
That too, yeah, that too.
The system has sort of built up all of these impediments towards people really talking about it, because, as you say, it sort of forces people to become pundits. You become spectators and rooting for your team, and so on. And Vote Pact is attempting to undermine that, to help foster dialogue between, people who might consider themselves leading Republican, others leading Democrat.
So what's the website if people want to do it, and can they click and say, I'm doing it anonymously?
The website is votepact.org, and people can, email me, and, I'd be very interested in, publishing pieces either, and I've never thought of it, but I'd be open to publishing anonymous pieces, especially if they come from pairs of people.
But can people just click a button, or do they have to write an essay?
No, we're not actively attempting. There's a Facebook community.
Yeah.
That's linked in with the web page. But we're not attempting to link people up because of the trust issue is central to this, right?
Oh, for sure. But I meant just to keep a count of how many pairs of people are doing it.
Yeah, I'm not attempting to keep a count, but that's a good suggestion. We could do that. Definitely do that.
Yeah, might be a good idea. We've got just a few minutes left, Sam, and I really wanted to ask you about something you wrote just last week called Layers of Islamophobia. Representative Ellison says he's unaware of Clinton having returned Muslim money. I bet a lot of people are unaware of that. What is that about?
Yeah, I don't expect the average person to be aware of it, but it's kind of remarkable that the first Muslim member of Congress was unaware of it.
Yeah, over $10 million from Saudi Arabia into her family foundation. Most people aren't aware of all the Muslim money she is getting, right?
Well, yeah, and that's, from a foreign country as opposed to the money that she returned in 2000, which was from U.S., people in the U.S., not to be xenophobic about it, but, just happened to be Arabs and Muslims, and she returned the money when she ran for the Senate.
Why did she do that?
I'm not in Clinton's head. I'm not sure why she did it. The New York Times said that it was because she didn't want to lose, quote-unquote, Jewish support. I don't know that that's
But there was a controversy in the news about it that she caved into.
Right, yeah. I mean, there was a, it seems, a concerted effort, you know, by Islamophobes to slam that and to taint that, and then she ended up just folding, and she would even refuse to meet with the Arab and Muslim folks involved. You know, and I mean, it was interesting. I was at the, I wrote that after I was at the news conference with Ellison and Carson, the two current Muslim members of Congress. And it was kind of frustrating because they talk about Islamophobia and they talk about Trump and Cruz and a bunch of other Republicans and so on, but there's virtually no sense of critique of U.S. foreign policy as to what the U.S. might be doing that might engender anger in Muslim countries. It's almost a sense of I got mine. We're Muslim Americans and we wanna, you know, have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be discriminated against. And that's the end of it. As if that they might have some knowledge or a greater degree of empathy. I mean, it shouldn't be. I mean, everybody should empathize with everybody, with Muslims and the fact that the U.S. has bombed Muslim country after Muslim country with devastating results, and certainly in Iraq and Libya and so on. There was no sense of that in how they discussed things, and I sort of get into, you know, why that is. And how we can, you know, sort of break out of that so that it's not just diversity for the nominal sake of it, but, you know, a diversity that actually helps, you know, change policy and create a more peaceful world.
I was a fan of Representative Keith Ellison when he was a state legislator in Minnesota and pushing through a resolution in support of impeaching George W. Bush over launching a war and so forth. He got to Washington, and I asked him, do you want to impeach Bush? And he said, oh, no, I wouldn't want to do anything like that. And now he's pushing for wars in Syria and Libya and so on. It seems like the basic trajectory of any Christian or Jew or atheist in Congress. You know, you get there and you abandon what got you there.
And it was funny, in their response to my question, they cited officials around Clinton who are Muslim. One of them is totally hilarious. I didn't know this person. I'm blanking out her name just now.
We have like 30 seconds, Sam.
Anyway, she ended up being reporting to Elliot Abrams at the Bush National Security Council.
Uh-huh.
So, she was, working for a leading warmonger.
And another one in Hillary Clinton. Sam Husseini, the Institute for Public Accuracy, check it out if you do not get their emails and are not aware of their work, and votepact.org, and check out Sam's work on his blog. We'll have all the links up at talknationradio.org. Sam, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Great talking with you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a coup and a corruption scandal that have government in disarray, an economic crisis, and an outbreak of a dangerous mosquito-borne virus have not a few people asking how Brazil can possibly host a successful and safe Olympic Games in just 1 month from now. Our guest has a different take, suggesting that Brazil's unrest might actually be a kind of boon to Olympic officials, in that it serves to distract from the myriad problems associated with hosting the Games, even when they go, quote-unquote, smoothly. Jules Boykoff teaches political science at Pacific University in Oregon. He's written three books now about the aspects of the Olympic Games that we don't see on TV, including how activism and dissent have always been in play. His most recent book is Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. Jules Boykoff will join us to talk about the upcoming Rio Games. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press. At FAIR, we never tire of saying the primary measure of media in an election is not how fair they are to this or that candidate, but how fair they are to the people. All of the people who are affected by the outcome of this particular process, such as it is, and need to see how it functions in relation to them and their needs and concerns. The people are the story, and how they are represented by a process that's ostensibly intended to do that. That corporate media don't see things that way is indicated by the resounding disinterest with which they greeted a poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. The survey from mid-May found fully 90% of voters lack confidence in the country's political system. 40% describe it as seriously broken. 70%, equal proportions of Democrats and Republicans, say they are frustrated by this election. 55% describe themselves as helpless. Only 17% think the Democratic Party is open to new ideas. 10% say that of Republicans. 7 in 10 think primaries and caucuses ought to be open, and 1 in 4 say they have hardly any confidence their vote will be counted. I want to underscore that these are registered voters, the ones who haven't become totally disaffected. Being published by AP, the survey could scarcely have been made more widely available to the press, but what pickup occurred was in your Crystal Lake, Illinois, Northwest Heralds and your Davenport, Iowa, Quad City Times. Not that there's anything wrong with them, but the Denver Post and the Christian Science Monitor seem to be the only big outlets interested in a pretty darn newsworthy set of findings. At minimum, media's pretense that they're reflecting the political pulse of the U.S. public while they're focused overwhelmingly on elections that majorities are unhappy with is like looking for your keys under the lamppost, not because that's where you lost them, but because the light's better. And by the way, while the most popular word people used to describe their feelings about the 2016 election was frustrated, the second most popular was interested. It's that combination of frustration and interest that's been drawing people together at events like Breaking Through Power, the four-day conference hosted recently by Ralph Nader, aimed at mobilizing civic organizations, media crickets. Last month, hundreds of people marched from the Liberty Bell to Capitol Hill in a protest called Democracy Spring, aimed at ending big money's power over politics and ensuring voting rights. That, too, fell into corporate media's abyss. It's hard not to figure that elite media prefer to just talk among themselves about what the public thinks and wants and deserves from the political process without having to actually listen to them. And finally, a majority of Americans support women's right to abortion, a fact that's been true for about two decades now. Support for that right actually increased after attacks on Planned Parenthood last year. And development experts have for decades, maybe centuries, identified women's right to control family size and birth timing as critical to communities' economic and social development. That's just by way of indicating how far removed from the reality of abortion is the U.S. media conversation about it, at least as represented by cable news. Rachel Laris and Sharon Kahn at Media Matters surveyed 14 months of evening cable news on Fox, CNN, and MSNBC. They found a discussion that's first of all dominated by the part of the population that don't have abortions. 62% of those talking in segments on the topic were men. 70% of those talking about it on Fox could be identified as anti-choice, but CNN also had three times the number of appearances by anti-choice guests as by pro-choice. Researchers tracked the incidence of certain types of misinformation, like the idea that birth control is abortifacient. Fox won that contest in a walk. And while women of color are disproportionately affected by restrictions like the Hyde Amendment, which bans abortion access for women who get their health care through Medicaid, only one guest in the 3-month study period was an advocate for reproductive rights for women of color. That guest, Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health, who appeared on All In with Chris Hayes, has made the point that Hyde was and is a deliberate attack on low-income women's reproductive freedom. Henry Hyde famously said he'd like to be able to prevent rich and poor women from deciding whether to have a child. Unfortunately, the only vehicle available is the Medicaid bill. Some states have workarounds for Hyde, but that just means something so crucial to a woman's life can be dependent on her zip code. And nearly half of Latinas and roughly 70% of black women live in states without public coverage of abortion, most of which are now also considered hostile due to newer state restrictions. More of that sort of economic and racial context would be one way to move media's abortion conversation beyond what this research suggests is a pretty unhelpful he said debate. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The World Health Organization says concerns about the Zika virus are no reason to postpone or cancel the Olympic Games scheduled to start August 5th in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Others cite the country's political and economic unrest. Brazil has had 3 sports ministers in the last 4 months as a reason to worry about the success of the Games. But what does the success of Olympic Games usually look like, such that our next guest would say that Brazil's current political chaos actually affords Rio organizers a tiny respite from deeper scrutiny? Jules Boykoff is the author of 3 books about the Olympics, most recently Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. He teaches political science at Pacific University in Oregon, and he spent last fall in Brazil looking into the country's preparation for the 2016 Games. He's also an athlete who represented the U.S. Olympic soccer team some years ago. He joins us now in studio. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jules Boykoff.
Thank you, Janine.
Well, the Rio Olympics do present some special circumstances. Every city is different, really. But some of the fundamental problems don't have to do with impeachment or mosquitoes. They're really the same problems that we saw in London or in Beijing. I know you wrote for Extra about Vancouver. What are some of those recurring problems, and how are they playing out in Brazil?
The Olympics have become huge over the years, a massive juggernaut that rolls into the host city and affects all sorts of things, economic, political, social, environmental. And some of these issues, as you say, continue to rise up time and time again. One of them is spending and how in the beginning, when the Olympics come to your town, they're supposed to cost one thing. In the end, they cost multiple times that. It's like an economic etch-a-sketch. On the front end, for example, London, the last Summer Olympics, was supposed to cost $3.8 billion. In the end, it cost at least $18 billion. So spending is definitely one of those things that comes up time and time again. Another one that often comes up is displacement. For example, in Beijing, 1.5 million people were displaced to make way for the Summer Olympics that year. 1.5 million. In Rio, we've seen 77,000 people being displaced for Olympic structures and for Olympic venues since Rio got the games in 2009. You also see the militarization of public space. In a sense, the Olympics create a situation where security officials can use the state like their own private ATM, getting all of the weapons that they would have never been able to get during normal political times, sometimes special rules and laws that allow them to monitor not just potential terrorists, but also activists as well. In fact, in Rio, there's actually a section in the Rio bid book called activism/terrorism, conflating the two. And we've seen that also in a number of Olympics prior to Rio.
It's interesting, you list these very serious things, and the New York Times, when they're writing about it, there is some awareness that there's some downside, but the New York Times in this April 27th piece referred to Rio facing the usual challenges that bedevil host cities, like delayed stadium construction and transportation concerns. Well, we're talking about things that are actually much deeper than that when you're talking about displacing over a million people, or in Rio, 77,000 people. I wanted to draw you out on each of those, really, but let's start with the displacement idea, because in Rio, I know that there is a particular focus on, although the mayor of Rio, Eduardo Paes, says no one's been displaced, there's evidence that people are being displaced, and particularly in this place, Villa Autódromo. And I know that that's a particularly salient example. Can you tell us a little about that?
Sure. Well, it's just staggering that the Rio mayor, Eduardo Paes, could say that there has been no displacement because of the Olympics. The city's own statistics say that 77,000 people have been displaced because of the Olympics. Villa Autódromo is a particularly poignant example. It's a fishing village that began in the 1960s that happens to be located along the edge of the Olympic Park out in Barra da Tijuca to the western zone of Rio de Janeiro. And it had many, many families there before, hundreds of families. Now they're down to about 20 families left, and they've fought a really hard struggle to keep their homes, to keep their space, to keep their community alive. And it's been a back and forth with the mayor, who's really flip-flop on this issue. First he says they're going to get to stay, then he says, nope, everybody's got to go. And a lot of people, when they settle and they get a monetary payout, get a settlement that does not nearly match what the value of their home is. And so there's all sorts of problems, even for people that manage to negotiate with the government and get a payout. So it's very sad. I went there numerous times over the course of my months in Rio this last fall, and I met incredible people. So on one hand, it's sad. On the other hand, I mean, it's just this incredible beacon of courage and tenacity in the face of power. And you know, I really admire the people who stood up at Villa Autódromo, as well as their allies across Rio de Janeiro. There's a group called Catalytic Communities, activists who've stood side by side. There's the Comité Popular da Copa do Mundo e das Olimpíadas, the popular committee of the World Cup and the Olympics, who've been right there the whole time with the residents, arm in arm with the residents of Villa Autódromo.
Well, and the thing that you were talking about displacement and the mayor sort of denying it's going on, Dave Zirin, who I know you work with on a lot of this stuff, was saying that it shows how much we've got to fight for the narrative going on here, you know. And it's interesting because in some ways the fact that the Olympic emperor has no clothes, if you will, that's kind of open knowledge. And that's why Brazil, in advance of these Olympics, they had this thing, this Ten Commandments, that was kind of saying we're not going to make these same mistakes. And one of the things that previous host cities have made, and they were going to try to avoid these pitfalls, and one of those had to do with whose money was going to be spent on it. Because one of the big issues is always about using public money to do things that wind up benefiting private interests. And in Rio, they said, oh, no, we're going to do it differently this time. Have they really done it differently?
Well, first of all, I think it's interesting that the low estimate of the Rio Olympics is $11 billion, and some media outlets have reported on it only $11 billion have been spent, $11 billion on the Olympics. And when that happens, you know that we've sort of become inured to, very used to, super high budgets for the Olympic Games. You hear from Rio officials that there's a huge amount of private input. That's incredibly deceptive. On one hand, there are these massive tax breaks for corporations, corporate sponsors of the Olympics, who will reap millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of tax breaks when they helicopter into Rio with their wares. A second, they include this northern zone, the zona portuaria, that really has nothing to do with the Olympics. And sure, that's being developed by private entrepreneurs, including, I might add, Donald Trump, who is apparently going to make Brazil great again as well. He's building five skyscrapers in this zona portuaria. But the fact is, there's no Olympic events in that area. So if you include that, you include all this private spending that's happening, and you thereby inflate the amount of private input. So it's actually the public that is paying a large portion, an abundance, a majority of the bill for the Rio 2016 Olympics. I think we really need to be on our toes with this Eduardo Paes. You mentioned Dave Zirin. He interviewed Paes face-to-face, and Paes said directly to him, he said, "The bike path that washed away had nothing to do with the Olympics." For your listeners that don't know about that, that was a footbridge and bike bridge that was built to connect a couple communities, and it was pitched as this big Olympic legacy, and it was washed away by huge waves. Shoddy construction appears to be at the root of it, and five people went missing. Two for sure have died. So a total tragedy. Paes can say with a straight face to Dave that this is not an Olympic legacy, whereas it definitely was. You look at the paperwork for all the Olympic bidding and for all the recent Olympic paperwork on this issue, and it's absolutely an Olympic legacy until it's not. And same thing with the tickets. When the 2014 World Cup was happening in Brazil, Eduardo Paes was a savvy enough politician to realize that it was a disaster for people in Rio. And he said, oh, the Olympics are going to be much better than that. And what we're going to do is we're going to give 1.2 million tickets to people who would otherwise not be able to afford them. Has he done that? Absolutely not. So my point is, we really need to keep a close eye on Eduardo Paes, the mayor of Rio, who, by the way, has aspirations to become President Paes, and a lot of people think he's going to become president of Brazil in the not-too-distant future.
Well, along with the amounts of money that are being spent and the source of them, what a lot of folks are concerned about is essentially the priorities that they reflect. In other words, why is any place spending all this money on this spectacle, essentially, when, as we understand it, hospitals are being closed, people are protesting and sitting in schools because of cuts to the education budget. And so, you know, there's also that. It's also about priorities, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's gobsmacking that hospitals are being shut down, social services are being dialed way back while they're spending billions on the Olympics. One example that really jumps out to me about priorities that you're talking about, Janine, is the construction of the Olympic Village. Typically, Olympic villages say a lot about the organizers in the host city. I really view the plans for the Olympic Village as ethical documents. And a lot of times in previous Olympics, the hosts have said, oh, we're going to turn these villages into places where we'll have mixed housing. It'll be a chance for lower-income people to move into these units and so on. Now, they have not always come through on that promise, that's for sure, but that's a separate story. In Rio, they're not even going along with that narrative at all. In fact, from the beginning, the plan was to convert the Olympic Village into luxury condominiums. And the place is called Ilha Pura, which is pure island. And the fact of the matter is, Ilha Pura isn't even an island, geophysically speaking. It's definitely a social island, but it's not even a geophysical island. And The Guardian interviewed Carlos Carvalho. He is the head of Carvalho Hoskin, who's building the Olympic Village and will flip them over into condominiums. And he made it very clear what the priorities were for him and his fellow one percenters. He said, the space afterward, Ilha Pura, will be a space for elites. It will not be a place for pores. I mean, it's like Montgomery Burns times 9 or something. And that absolutely gives us a clue to what the priorities are in for organizers of the Olympics. And it also raises an important point. For all the debt that occurs for cities, there are certain swaths of elites who absolutely benefit from the Olympics. And we need to keep our eye on that as well. Certain elites do tend to reconstitute class power through the Olympic Games.
Well, I was going to say that it's a fiasco or whatever wouldn't mean that it wasn't very lucrative for some. You know, a failure for some would not be a failure for all. And also on that point, the New York Times, writing about how, you know, Rio is promised these transit projects and they might not get them together in time, for example, and there's some concern about whether everything's going to fall into place. But this New York Times article said, well, these projects might not materialize, but then they say, to the vast majority of people watching the games on television, however, such infrastructure may not matter. And that seemed to me to be almost pointing to the fact that, you know, that it could succeed in a Potemkin village kind of way, that it almost said it matters more what it looks like on TV than what happens on the ground.
Well, it definitely points up the fact that money matters with the Olympics. Media money matters with the Olympics. NBC has forked over $4.4 billion for four Olympic Games that include Rio. And they're not going to take any chances here. That's why you're not going to see the Games moved unless some incredible catastrophe happens before Rio. Not even Zika is going to get the thing moved. There's too much money at stake, too many power brokers who are going to make some money off of this deal, and media are absolutely at the center of it. And you're right, it's a little frustrating when the people of a city are sort of brushed aside in their actual interests. The extension of the metro line, Linea Cuatro as it's known in Rio, that's actually could be a benefit for everyday people in Rio. This is could be one of the very few positive legacies of the Rio Olympics. And they're pushing up right up to the very end as to whether they're even going to get it done. They're saying they might open it 4 days now before the Olympics start. I've also read in the Brazilian press that they might make it a direct line straight from Ipanema and Copacabana, which is to say the richer part of Rio de Janeiro along the south zone, straight as a pipeline into Barra da Tijuca, where the Olympics are going to be. In other words, skipping straight through, just ramming straight through the communities and not even stopping off there. And that would be a total travesty, and it would be incredibly symbolic about how everyday people are left to the side in the name of spectacle, in the name of speculation.
When you look at the story of the Rio Olympics, the Zika virus really is kind of at the center of it right at the moment. The World Health Organization has responded to this letter from lots of health officials who said they thought it was a bad idea for people to go. What's your take on that angle of things?
Well, first, Jeanine, I'm a political scientist, not a medical scientist, so I should say that straight up front. I think when I read about Zika in the U.S. press, I've seen a tendency where the media frame it as a real danger to first world tourists who might become ill should they travel. And in other words, kind of focusing on a privileged sliver of the global 1% who might travel to Rio and really worrying about that small swath of elites who might make the trip. What that narrative leaves out, of course, is the everyday people of Rio who don't have the choice to move and who will be there no matter what. There are important considerations that we should take into consideration with Zika, and one of them is the fact that they have already between 5 and 8 million tourists per year. They just had millions come in for Carnival, and we didn't hear about this. And Carnival, by the way, was during a high mosquito season. The Olympics will be happening in August, which up here in the North America is, of course, summer, but in South America, it's winter. For the mosquitoes, that means they won't be breeding quite as quickly, so it should be a low time. So there are some mitigating factors with Zika, but I'm really on my guard when I hear people talking about Zika if they're not also talking about everyday people. If Zika and discussing it in the press can be a way of putting pressure on the Brazilian government to offer more support to combat poverty, which really is at the root of the Zika issue, then I'm all for it. But if the people from Rio themselves get swept aside, I think we have a real problem.
Well, one of the things that your work has brought out is the role that dissent and activism have always played in the Olympics. We have an image of athletes as kind of, you know, Captain America types who don't criticize, you know, powerful institutions. And it's just not true. And the Olympics, of course, is a time where the world is watching. And I understand finally that that is why you hope that Rio won't be canceled and that it could, in fact, be used as a spotlight on political and popular dissent.
That's right. The Olympics have given an unwitting gift to the people of Rio, and that is the opportunity to protest when the global media descends on their city and get some attention for these key and important issues that plague the city from an international press. You're right that the history of the Olympics is full of interesting examples of athlete activism. From the 1906 Olympics, when Peter O'Connor, an Irish athlete, was forced to participate under the Union Jack because at the time Ireland was being governed by Westminster. And when he won a medal, he climbed over to the pole and he shimmied up it and he held the Union Jack to the side and waved an Ireland Forever flag instead while his buddies from Ireland watched from the ground. The Carlos Smith, Peter Norman episode you were referencing. And even more recently, Damien Hooper at the 2012 London Olympics, an Aboriginal boxer from Australia who wore a shirt into the ring that had the Aboriginal flag on it. So it can absolutely be a pedestal for courageous athletes. One athlete I'm really keeping an eye on this year is a guy named Lawrence Halstead. He's a fencer from Team GB, Team Great Britain, who's already qualified for Rio, so he's going to be there. And he wrote an essay in The Guardian that I urge your listeners to take a look at, where he says that athletes, if they don't speak up, can be considered implicit in the problem, and that he hopes that a sort of critical mass of athletes will come together and speak up on the issues that are plaguing Rio while the Olympics are in town. So we need to keep an eye on that. I think we need to show solidarity for courageous athletes like Lawrence Halstead. You also have movements that sort of piggyback the event, if you will, piggyback off of the Olympics and sort of hijack it for their own political purposes. It is a real rare chance for activists who've been working on issues forever to get the attention of the world on them. And I mentioned some of the activist groups before. I had the good fortune of meeting many people who are activists across Rio. Interesting fact is that over the last year, there have been more protesters that have hit the streets across Brazil than have hit the streets in the rest of the world combined. Now, of course, that includes right-wing protesters protesting Dilma Rousseff, but it also includes a lot of left-of-center protesters. So you have seasoned activists with a list of grievances, and these international band of elites come into their town. It seems like a perfect recipe for banding together and asking big questions about what matters for your city.
We've been speaking with Jules Boykoff. The new book is Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. Jules Boykoff, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This week on Radio Eco Shock, we're going to look at a life that shaped energy expectations, a whole social movement, an American military policy in the Middle East, as it turns out. Finally, there is a biography of M. King Hubbard, the man who warned oil companies and the world about peak oil. We'll ask author Mason Inman about the man, his legacy, and what it means now in this brief time of oil glut. Then I'll check in with Australian extreme weather specialist Lisa Alexander to get her measure of the record-setting Indian heat wave, which is now cooling to the monsoon rains. First, a couple of news notes. 2 weeks ago, we talked about Exelon, America's largest power company, demanding more subsidy to keep its aging reactors going in the state of Illinois. With no public support and no action from the legislature, Exelon has now announced two Illinois nuclear plants will close. The Quad Cities reactors were built in 1972 using the same faulty General Electric Mark I reactor design as the four reactors which blew up at Fukushima, Japan. One more of those darn reactors gone, with 22 left running in the United States. The other Illinois nuclear plant, the Clinton reactor, was built later in 1987 with a different design, but it was also plagued with safety issues. Illinois has not and will not go dark. Electricity from cheaper natural gas plants and, increasingly, wind power delivered from the Midwest will power that state with far less chance of an accident that lasts for thousands of years. The late anti-nuclear campaigner Michael Marriott battled against these reactors for years, including on Radio EcoShock, and now he's won. Over to California. You remember the giant natural gas reservoir that spewed methane into the skies of California and the world atmosphere? The Aliso Canyon storage facility is still closed. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has expressed concerns that California could experience rolling blackouts this summer as hotter days mean more power demand for air conditioning, and it's simmering in that state right now. It's a state drowning in potential solar power sites. Too bad it's not realized yet. Of course, no sooner did the Indian heat wave give way than Europe was hit with another extreme rainfall event. Parts of Paris flooded, as you know. The historic Louvre Museum had to move some of its priceless collection. People were swept away and died in the same extreme rain system in Germany, and that's following a storm that dropped over 300,000 lightning strikes in Europe. I could bounce from one extreme weather event to the next until Radio EcoShock becomes a kind of weather porn station. Except I try to find the climate science behind these abnormal twists when major media fails to tell us what is causing it all. Anyway, not this week. We have the story of M. King Hubbard, the man who changed so many of our lives.
This is Radio Eco Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
Oil and gas and coal will not last forever, and a civilization built on those fuels cannot last forever either. But for how long, and then what? That's the question asked by the peak oil movement, after it was answered by one of the energy giants of the 20th century. In the 1950s, while working for Shell Oil, the American geologist and geophysicist M. King Hubbard described the curve of fossil fuels. After being ignored, he was rediscovered in the 1970s, but few people know much about the man or really understand his theory. Only now has the first authoritative biography of M. King Hubbard emerged. It's by Mason Inman, an award-winning science writer who's been published in everything from Scientific American to Wired magazine. The title of the book is The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. Mason, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get a bit of a snapshot to start. Why did you spend the last 5 years chasing down this biography of M. King Hubbard?
Well, part of it was just that it turned out Hebert was this fascinating character who was interested in a lot of the same things that I was getting interested in. And I began to read more about his work and found that I had a lot to learn from what he had done, even though he died 25 years ago and the bulk of his work was done even earlier than that. But I can tell you a little bit more about how I got interested in this topic in the first place. I was reporting on climate science for a number of years for places like Nature and Science, and I ran across this idea of peak oil, the idea that oil production might hit a peak at some point and then enter a long decline. And I hadn't heard people talking about this really at all. And I started to read more, and the people in the climate community just said that the problem is there's too much fossil fuels and we have to find ways of keeping them in the ground. But then when I read more, I realized that it's not the same for every fossil fuel. There's definitely a lot more coal than we can burn, but oil is more limited. And at that point, when I was starting to get interested in it in 2010, the price of oil had already spiked way up over $150 a barrel. And so it seemed that there were problems with supplying enough, even when the price had gone up a lot and companies had started investing a lot more in exploration and in drilling and so on. So it seemed to me like the story was more complicated than just that there's too much fossil fuels. And so I kept digging, and this guy Hebert kept coming up. And when I read more about him, it turned out that he was this big picture thinker who was thinking not just about how to forecast the future of oil, but about the role of energy in society and the long-term fate of civilization. And so I thought, wow, this guy is really interesting, but there's no biography of him. I wanted to read one if there was one, but there wasn't. So I decided to try to write one myself.
And good thing you did. Now, listeners, you know that peak oil spawned a worldwide movement holding international conferences, and now it seems we're awash in oil, so the question is always, is this relevant? Is peak oil dead? And I promise we'll get into that later in the interview. But first, I'd really like to go, Mason, back to the 1950s when Hebert first proposed the curve of peak oil. How could an American geologist know how much oil and gas the Earth might hold?
So, yeah, in the 1950s, Hebert was working at Shell Oil at that time, and he was the head of research there on exploration and production of oil. So basically, he was one of the oil industry's top researchers. And he'd been following oil issues, for a long time, even though most people in the industry weren't worried about whether the industry would be able to supply enough oil. Hebert was worried about it, and we can get into that more later about how he came to be worried about it when others weren't. But when he looked at the estimates that existed at that time for how much oil would probably be available in the U.S. and then also in the whole world, he realized that production in the U.S. would probably reach a peak in the not-too-distant future, because you wouldn't just be able to use up all the oil and then suddenly use the last barrel and then the production just stops at that point. Instead, it would go up to a peak and then it would get harder and harder to get enough oil and the production would decline over decades. And if it follows this kind of smooth curve that he's become famous for, then he said it looks like the peak for U.S. oil production would come a lot sooner than most had expected, based on generally well-accepted estimates of how much oil the nation would ultimately extract. But he pointed out that even if there was a fair amount more oil than what people were expecting at that time, that it still would not delay the peak all that much. So he was expecting that it would come around 1965 to 1970. And so he was saying this in 1956 was when he issued his first forecast along these lines. But nobody believed it, even though he was using numbers that, you know, estimates for oil that were well accepted. So as he put it once, I didn't come up with any new figures. I just showed them what the old figures meant. But as soon as he made this argument, people began coming up with much bigger estimates because they didn't like his conclusions. And it might not have been completely conscious that they thought, well, we just need to come up with bigger numbers in order to avoid this conclusion.
Yeah, you know, Saudi Arabia is doing that all the time. I mean, the whole Middle East, all of a sudden, they just bumped up their reserves tremendously without really explaining that they'd done any new discoveries.
Right. And then since they bumped it up, then they've held it constant for almost 30 years, where it's just not believable as a real number based on geology and economics.
Well, in a YouTube video that I found that's called Health Facilities and the Energy Crisis, where actually he says nothing about health facilities, but he really explains the theory pretty well. He shows a graphic of the past 5,000 years of human history with a little blip of less than 300 years, which is our times, our fossil fuel civilization. Talk to us about that blip, that little window in time that he saw.
Yeah, I mean, with this graph, which he showed in papers and talks over decades, he was really trying to get people to think about the long term, to realize how unusual the situation is that humanity is in right now, where we did not have this kind of energy at our disposal in centuries past. And now we've found various ways to extract all these fossil fuels and add a little bit more energy from other sources other than fossil fuels. But mostly it's been in fossil fuels that have been responsible for all this increase in energy that we have. And along with that, there's been a huge increase in the population on the planet and in the impact that we have on the planet, including climate change and deforestation and all sorts of other impacts that we're having. And a lot of times people would think about the short term and think of this kind of growth that we're going through as something normal and something that would just keep going indefinitely for the foreseeable future, people would often say. His general point was, let's try to foresee farther into the future. Let's not just say the foreseeable future is the next 5 or 10 years. Let's think about where we're going over 100 years or 1,000 years. So that's why he was presenting that kind of graph, to try to break people out of their normal thinking about the relatively short term.
Now, there is one other theory of oil production. I mean, Mason, Hubert said that oil came from plant material that just wasn't decayed properly and built up over a long period of time. And there's a whole theory of how that oil is made. But there is another theory out there, the abiotic theory of oil production, that somehow oil is very plentiful and produced by some action in the Earth's crust or something. Did you look into that?
I've read about it in the past. I don't know of anybody serious who's still promoting that idea, so I didn't spend very much time looking into it. I mean, there was the one Nobel Prize-winning physicist, I believe, Thomas Gold, who had argued for this idea, or at least that it should be tested. And my understanding is that the tests were done, and they showed that the abiotic idea was wrong. I'm not sure it's worth going into the details, but if anybody wants to look it up, they can search around for what Thomas Gold was saying and for the tests that tried to put his idea.
Right. I just wanted to knock that out as a fringe idea that you should avoid, because that isn't what happened. Anyway, let's dive back to the 1930s in New York for the formation of this man. King Hubbert became involved in both academia and industry even before he finished his PhD. And during the Great Depression, Hubbert was one of the prime founders of a theory and a movement called technocracy. Can you give us just a brief primer on technocracy? What's that?
Sure. So this was a movement that these scientists and engineers formed in the depths of the Great Depression because things were so bad and the business leaders and politicians and so on didn't have a very good explanation of what had gone wrong and didn't have very good ideas about how to try to get things working again. And so in this void of ideas, Hubbert and some others began building this group that they called Technocracy. And it argued that the problem was that machines were putting people out of work and that society had not adjusted to that. And they didn't see this as a problem. They thought it was actually a good thing that machines could replace labor. And they thought we should keep developing machines to replace even more labor. but they also thought we should change society in order to share the products of all these machines equally between people. And they argued that everybody would be able to work relatively short hours and have enough to have a decent life. So people could work maybe 16 hours a week, and then they would have a lot of time left over for reading or playing music or whatever it is that they would want to do. That's not directly related to producing what we need to get by every day.
But we, who are all that are left of the old engineers and mechanics, have pledged ourselves to salvage the world. We have the airways, all that's left of them. We have the seas. And we have ideas in common. The brotherhood of efficiency. The Freemasonry of science. We're the last trustees of civilization when everything else has failed.
I've been waiting for this.
Well, I'm particularly interested in the technocracy idea to substitute energy certificates for money. And maybe this could be a solution to drive a reduction in emissions if we get paid in maybe carbon emission allowances. What was Hubbert proposing there?
Yeah, so this was an idea that came from the guy who's really the founder of technocracy, an engineer named Howard Scott. And then Hubbert helped him develop the idea a bit when they formed technocracy. And so the idea is that we need modern forms of energy like electricity from burning coal and things like that to power all the machines that we rely on for producing things in factories or for running farm equipment and so on. And so they thought that it would make more sense to have everything paid for in terms of the energy that it took to create it rather than using dollars, which don't have any real fixed value. They can just float in value depending on what is going on with the economy at that point. There can be inflation or deflation and so on. So they thought this would, using the energy certificates, would be a better way to manage society, and they would be able to keep things running smoothly so that they could produce enough goods without having these big booms and busts like the U.S. had gone through at that point. So the idea was probably naive in a lot of different ways, but it was still interesting to think about how could you change the monetary system and how we allocate goods between people and so on in order to try to basically make things better for everybody instead of just allowing whoever has the money to have more power.
So briefly, what happened to the technocracy movement? Did it die or is it alive today?
It is still around. The organization still exists, and I went to their headquarters, which is now in a small town called Ferndale in northern Washington, right near the Canadian border, and they still have all of their old papers and so on, which they were very gracious and let me go through, and which was really helpful for the research for the book. But there are very, very few members of the group anymore, so in all practical sense, they've pretty much died off. They haven't really put out much new literature over the years either. So Hubbert wrote a book called The Technocracy Study Course back in the mid-1930s. And that was a time when the movement was really booming. After Hubbert and others first put the idea out there, then they got a lot of media attention. People started forming these study groups spontaneously around the country. And so the organization Technocracy began trying to organize these groups, and Hubbert wrote this book in order to try to help people go through some of the fundamentals of how modern society works. And he talked about energy supplies and economic growth and all sorts of other issues that he thought was important for anybody to know if they really wanted to understand how things work.
And that's all the stuff they should be teaching right now in schools, I think.
Yeah, so, I mean, if they made an updated version of something along the lines of what he was doing, I think it could be really useful. And so Hubbert definitely was drawing on his experience as a teacher when he was writing it. And so at the time, he was a lecturer at Columbia University in geophysics, and he had started teaching on that topic even when he was still doing his graduate degree at University of Chicago. And through his whole life, he always enjoyed teaching, and he thought education was really the key to trying to get people to think differently about energy and how we organize society and to try to come around to something that he considered more rational.
So in a podcast with Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, you described Hubbert as stubborn, and maybe that's a prerequisite for an oracle who's going against the mainstream, even in his own industry. What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were a few other people who had somewhat similar forecasts to his, but they weren't as stubborn as he was. They didn't stick with it in saying, you know, here's the evidence that I have. I'm going to gather more evidence to try to convince you. I'm going to keep hammering away at this message and try and get people to take it seriously. And unfortunately, in the U.S., he still was not able to get people to take it seriously before the U.S. oil production hit a peak in 1970. But afterward, not immediately, but after several years, people did belatedly realize, oh, this is the thing that Hubbert had predicted. And I think it was helpful to have had his ideas out there beforehand so that people understood what was going on and that it was not some kind of conspiracy or something by the oil companies to just jack up the price of oil, that there were reasons why the U.S. was not able to produce as much as people in the country wanted and why they would need to cut back on their consumption and so on if they wanted to avoid being completely at the mercy of OPEC producers.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Mason Inman. He's the author of a new biography of M. King Hubbert, The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. What sort of guy was he? Was M. King Hubbert a family man?
No. he didn't have any kids, and he also was not that interested in spending time with his own family. He grew up on a farm in central Texas, one of the poorest parts of the country at that time. He was born there in 1903. And he was, you know, clearly brilliant from a young age and didn't have a lot in common with other people in his family. So he basically took off from Texas as soon as he could and went off to University of Chicago and was able to get into college there.
But he did, you know, come from oil country, and he went into the oil business. I guess he was a success. Do you think he would have driven a Cadillac?
He had a Mercedes at one point when he was older. But most of the time he drove a Chevy, which was, you know, a much cheaper car. And then he, when he got older and was close to retiring from Shell, if I remember right, then he splurged and bought a Mercedes when he was over in Germany on a lecture tour, and he had it shipped back to the U.S.
Later in life, say in the 1960s or 70s, did Hubbert find an acceptable political party given his early technocracy views?
So, yeah, I mean, I think he was always a bit frustrated with politics because he wanted to see things change a lot more and a lot faster than they did. But at the same time, he did support some politicians. He became friends with two brothers that were in politics, Stuart Udall and Mo Udall. And Stuart Udall was Secretary of Interior in the 60s, and then he and Hubbert became friends in the 70s. And I believe it was in 1976, Mo Udall, who was a U.S. senator, if I remember right, he ran for president. And he had a shot, even though he wasn't one of the leaders, and Hubbert, you know, contributed to his election funds and so on. So he was, you know, there were some politicians who he did support because he felt that they were starting to realize some of these issues about that, you know, we can't just have as much oil as we want forever. We can't just assume that economic growth is going to keep going on indefinitely, and that we should take measures to try to conserve energy and different things like this that, you know, were small steps, but he thought that they were steps in the right direction.
And how did Hubbert's work relate to the Club of Rome report that was released in the 1970s called Limits to Growth? And did he influence that report?
It seems that he did have some influence on that report. That report was written by several researchers at MIT. And in going through Hubbard's papers, I found a letter from one of the researchers, Dennis Meadows. And he was writing to Hubbard before that report came out, but when I believe it was in the process of doing the analysis or the writing. And he suggested to Hubbard that they collaborate and said that their team had gotten inspiration from Hubbard. When I saw this letter, I thought that was really interesting, and I got a hold of Dennis Meadows and was able to talk to him about it. And he said they got inspiration from a lot of places, but Hubbard was one of the sources. It would have been interesting to see what would have happened if they had collaborated, but it never worked out, partly because Hubbard thought he was working for the U.S. Geological Survey at that time, and he thought it wasn't appropriate for him as a government researcher to be collaborating with them. But also, Hubbard was just not very good at collaborating with people in general. He had strong feelings about how work should be done, and it made it so that he was difficult to work with.
And you've also said that worries about peak oil rebounded in an unfortunate way in the Carter Doctrine of American military dominance of oil supplies in the Middle East. Did people in the Carter White House know about M. King Hubbard?
They did. The Secretary of Energy at that time, James Schlesinger, he knew about Hubbard's work, and when I interviewed him before he died, he said that he actually had planned to give Hubbard a national medal in order to highlight the work he had done and how he was raising important issues that the U.S. and the world needed to grapple with. But then Schlesinger was also a very stubborn, abrasive person like Hubbard, and Schlesinger wound up getting fired by Carter before he was able to give Hubbard this national medal, so that never happened. Schlesinger had been in the Nixon and Ford administrations before the Carter administration as head of the CIA and as Secretary of Defense. And at that time, when the 1973 OPEC oil embargo began, he and Kissinger were talking about invading the Middle East, invading the United Arab Emirates, or I guess it was maybe before they were united, but they were talking about invading Abu Dhabi, which is right next to Saudi Arabia, and to send a message to Saudi Arabia and the other members of OPEC that they should not, you know, raise the price too much and exploit their position as holders of these huge reserves of relatively cheap oil. But they fortunately, in my view, did not ever follow through on those plans to invade. But these kind of ideas were bouncing around for a long time through the Nixon and Ford and Carter administrations, and then arguably into the Bush administrations, Bush Senior and Bush Junior. So that's one of the things I really worry about, is that if we do run into oil crunches, that there'll be a push to just try and seize oil from wherever it's available.
Okay, and how did Hubbard handle his growing fame as an older man, and how did he handle his senior years? I guess he passed away when, 1989?
Yeah. So he kept working up until the end as much as he could. He had some health problems, but his mind was still very much there. And in the early 80s, when Hubbard was a bit over 80 years old, he was still trying to see how he could improve his forecast. The approach that he had taken for forecasting world oil production, he knew was pretty rough. And he was trying to get better data so that he could try to improve those. And I think that says a lot about him, that he wasn't content to just put out a forecast and say, this is how it is. You know, he always wanted it to be based on the best possible data and wanted to keep doing the work as long as he could.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're going to move to the present and the future as we talk with Mason Inman, the author of a biography of M. King Hubbard called The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future, and that's something we all want. I got a few questions now about our present situation in 2016. My first one is, why did Hubbard miss the whole fracking boom? Or did he?
To give a little bit of background, he was the one that first explained how fracking works back in the mid-1950s. So then people say, well, why didn't he see this coming? You know, he knew how fracking worked. So to be fair, basically nobody else was expecting that fracking would become so big in these particular kinds of rock formations that have turned out to be amenable to fracking. And so even, you know, in 2010, long after Hubbard died, most analysts were not expecting a big boom of production in the U.S. But Hubbard's forecasts for conventional oil production, not fracking shale, but the other sources where you drill a hole in the ground and oil comes out, his forecasts for that were actually very close to how things have turned out over many decades since he issued those forecasts. And I don't know of many forecasts over that kind of length of time that are as close as his forecasts. Oh, some people say, so then, you know, with fracking and other unconventional sources like tar sands, then it's just showed that Hubbard was completely wrong. But he knew that there were various unconventional sources that were generally more expensive, and that as it became harder to get enough conventional oil out of the ground, that people would turn to these other sources. So it's not that he didn't know that they existed or just thought that they would not contribute anything. I think people sometimes get carried away and they see how the oil production in the U.S. has risen really quickly, and they infer from that that it is going to be a huge contributor for a very long time. But I think those analyses are not very good a lot of the time, and we need to do better analyses to understand what the long-term fate of the production from fracking will be.
Well, and then as we talked about, the peak oil movement became international, and there were forums with speakers and all of that, and I've done quite a few radio programs about it. Lately, it's gone somewhat silent with some of its members morphing over into the movement on climate change. Is peak oil as a social movement just in hiatus? Will it return, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely died down. A lot of people who were concerned about it before have gone kind of quiet, as you said. And I think part of it is a lot of people assumed that it would kind of lead to something more disastrous than has happened, and that things would play out somewhat smoothly where you would have a peak and then the decline would start and so on. But the reality has been messy, where we've had a plateau of conventional oil production over the last decade. The price of oil spiked way up. There was a global recession that was the worst in several decades that, you know, cut into how much people wanted to consume. And then now there's the fracking boom, and then the fracking bust. It's been a real roller coaster ride over the last 15 years or so. And it's difficult to tease out from all of that exactly where things are heading. But I think if you look at it carefully, then you can get a better idea of where things are going.
Sooner or later, we will run out. I mean, that curve is a for sure thing. We just don't know when. And that's, I think, what the debate is about. And meanwhile, though, the American author and professor Michael Clare says peak demand will come before peak oil ever develops. In an article in Common Dreams, he writes, according to the experts, and I may get this name wrong, Thijs van de Graaf and Aviel Verbruggen, overall world peak demand could be reached as early as 2020. And I'm guessing from the article that that's due to a combination of uncertainty about fossil supply, climate-driven emissions regulations and costs, transition to other forms of energy. So my question for you, Mason Inman, what do you think about Clare's statement on peak demand? Would that change Hubbard's work?
Well, to put it in perspective, Hubbard was trying to get people to switch off of oil. He wasn't just saying oil production will decline and we're all doomed. He was saying we need to plan ahead to switch over to other things. And if we really planned ahead, then what would happen might be something much like what these peak demand people are talking about, where the price of oil would not skyrocket and we would be making a big effort in order to switch over to alternatives. And, you know, the transition away from oil would be relatively smooth. And so in that sense, if people really took Hubbard's forecast seriously, they could be sort of a self-defeating prophecy where if people looked back in 2050 or 2100, they'd go, oh, that Hubbard guy was worried about peak oil, but it was fine because we made this transition off of oil. It was no problem. But I don't think that, you know, is by any means inevitable that it'll play out that way. A lot of times people talk about peak demand, but they don't really talk about prices. And to me, it's a bit strange when we've already had a big spike in oil prices where clearly, you know, the demand was running ahead of what could be supplied. And now we've had a crash in the price, and people seem to treat it as though this is a new permanent state of affairs. And I don't think that it is. We can see that the oil companies are struggling financially with the price where it is. They're cutting back their spending on exploration production drastically. And that is going to lead to less oil production in the years to come. So there's starting to be more and more warnings from various people, you know, including the International Energy Agency, that these cutbacks that we're seeing now in investment in the oil industry could well come back to bite us in a few years down the road. And so it's far from clear to me that we are at the start of a smooth transition away from oil. We have a very, very long way to go. But if we did do that and we did make a smooth transition away, even if it was because people were more worried about climate change and not so worried about whether there would be enough oil in the decades to come, then I think that would be a good thing. But I, you know, wrote this book because I'm not sure that we really are going to make a smooth transition like that. And I'm worried that oil prices will spike up again, that we'll wind up spending a lot of money, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, on drilling wells and so on in order to keep our oil fueled economy going while we try to make this transition away from oil. And this is money that we could be spending on getting off of oil instead of just trying to keep supplying enough oil to keep our cars running and so on right now.
And he was concerned about population. I mean, he says that the fossil fuel age is a short blip in human history, and that when energy supplies begin to run out, we will not be able to support the current large population. To me, that means either a complete change in reproduction within a generation or so, or a die-off. What did Hubbard say about that?
Well, he was definitely concerned about population, and he encouraged people to not have too many kids. He and his wife had no kids, and he was a longtime supporter of birth control, so he was giving money to Planned Parenthood and other groups like that, in particular ones that would help poorer women get access to birth control because they might not know what was available or might not easily have access. And he thought everyone should be able to control their births as they see fit. So he was definitely concerned about these things. He didn't talk about dire scenarios of die-offs or anything like that, but he did want people to change, you know, how many kids they have, how they consume energy, and so on, in order to try to avoid bad outcomes. And he was concerned that if we did not make these kind of transitions soon enough, that we would essentially run into a myriad of problems, and civilization as we know it would sort of gradually fizzle out instead of continuing on for hundreds or even thousands of years.
Well, now, Hubbard promoted moving to different sources of energy, as you say, Mason Inman. Talk to us about his thoughts on nuclear energy.
So he was a big supporter of nuclear power starting in the 1950s. But then over the years, his views gradually changed, and eventually he came out as a strong opponent of nuclear power. And this had a lot to do with his involvement with the Atomic Energy Commission. So he was an advisor to them through this panel of the National Academy of Sciences that he was on, where they were advising on nuclear waste disposal, you know, how to try to take care of the waste that's produced in a safe way. And he did not like the Atomic Energy Commission. He thought that they were handling nuclear waste in a sloppy way and that they didn't want to be bothered with trying to do things properly. And so he never quite put it this way, but essentially he was, it seems that he thought it was a great technology, but that people weren't handling it well. He was also following other energy technology development, and he was skeptical about whether solar power would ever become big, but as the technology improved, he became a lot more enamored with solar power, and then finally in the early 70s, he said, you know, I've changed my mind, I've turned around 180 degrees, I used to be a big proponent of nuclear power, and now I think it's, you know, dangerous and not the way to go, and I think that we should be putting huge efforts into solar power. And he was not only talking about PV panels where they produce electricity from solar energy, but he was also arguing for trying to develop solar fuels where you use solar power in order to create liquid fuels that you could send through pipelines and so on. And I'm not sure that he thought that would be a solution forever, but that it could be useful to help keep some of the infrastructure running that we have and be able to use all the pipelines we have and work with the cars that we have and so on. But in general, he was trying to see what kind of energy sources would be able to keep running for the very long term, meaning hundreds of years at least. And so one of his big beefs with nuclear power was that people were developing these light water reactors, the kind that we have now. But they essentially burn uranium sort of like a fossil fuel. But if they had developed these breeder reactors, they would create more nuclear fuel as they ran and would be able to make much better use of the uranium that's in the ground and be able to keep running for a very long time. But there was not a lot of effort put into these breeders, so that was one another reason why he was not happy with how nuclear power had developed. So he, you know, turned to renewables because he said these are going to keep going indefinitely and we should be turning to those as our long-term sources of energy.
Well, oil still powers the world, and given the possibilities, I mean, all sorts of things could happen. We could have deindustrialization if it becomes scarce. We could have a depression worse than in the 1930s. He always thought that one was an artificial depression. So given these possibilities, do you think Hubbard was a pessimist or an optimist about the direction the future will really take?
I mean, it was a little bit of both. I mean, he was a pessimist in the sense that he didn't think that markets would just magically lead to all the technologies and so on that we would need in order to keep things running as people expected, and would not be able to keep growth of consumption and growth of populations and so on going indefinitely. So for that reason, a lot of people have seen him as kind of a doomer and a naysayer and so on. But on the other hand, he was always optimistic that people would be able to look at where we're heading and be able to change course and come up with a better way of running things that would be more rational, be more fair, and be really sustainable. And so that's what kept him going with the papers that he was writing and the talks that he gave and so on over decades, even when people were not really listening to what he was saying, because he was optimistic that eventually the message would get through to enough people that it would lead to change. Or at least, you know, he thought he had to try, because otherwise, you know, what's the other option? You just give up. So, you know, he kept hammering away at these ideas and trying to get people to take them seriously.
Mason, does your new book have a website, a Facebook page, or some other way people can follow you and get the book?
Yeah, it does have a website. It's just oracleofoil.com. Or if you just, you know, search around for that and my name, Mason Inman, then I'm sure you can find it. And the book's available through all major booksellers like Amazon and Apple iBooks and Barnes & Noble and whatever format you want. And if anyone wants to read a bit of the book before they buy it, if you go to my website and sign up for my mailing list, then I'll send you a free download of the epilogue of the book, which covers events since Hubbard's death and talks about where things might be heading. And then hopefully that will pique people's interest and they'll want to hear about how we got to that point and read the rest of the book.
We've been talking with the widely published science journalist Mason Inman about his pivotal new book, The Oracle of Oil, A Maverick Geologist's Quest for a Sustainable Future. Incredibly, it's the first full biography of one of the most influential people in recent history, the man who discovered peak oil, M. King Hubbard. I'll have more links to everything we've talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, and you can find out more at the book website, oracleofoil.com. Mason, thank you for this work and for telling us about it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith, your host on Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The gigantic and record-setting heat wave over India has started to break up as the monsoon rains begin to develop in the south. Last week, the heat moved from northwest India, including the Punjab, toward the northeastern Indian states. Is the 2016 heat wave in Pakistan and India a beginning example of what we can expect in a warming world? Here to help is Dr. Lisa Alexander, an extreme weather specialist and senior researcher at the Climate Change Research Institute at the University of New South Wales in Australia. Lisa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex.
So what is your take on the record-breaking heat wave that swept over India in May 2016?
Well, I mean, India is certainly known for its unbearable conditions at this time of year and just before the monsoon, as you said, which has just started or beginning to start. But this has been a particularly hot season, and we have seen some record-breaking temperatures, especially up in the northwest of India. And it basically also comes on the back of a massive drought, which tends to exacerbate heatwave conditions, both intensity and duration. Add to this sort of the effects of aerosols that you get from wood-burning fuels that people burn in their home, and then obviously you have very unpleasant conditions. So certainly it's the type of thing we'd expect at this time of year, but obviously there have been some records broken.
Yes, it kind of went over the top. I know Australia had to add new heat zones to its maps a couple of years ago. Is this kind of extreme heat common, or is it becoming more common?
Well, I mean, there's certainly places in the world, obviously, that do experience temperatures that we've seen, and you've seen in India we got up to 51 degrees Celsius. So obviously incredibly hot temperatures, but we do see those sorts of temperatures in places, including Australia and the Middle East and North Africa, and even in Death Valley in the United States. So these types of temperatures do exist, and we do get them in the world, but certainly in the warming world that we have seen over the last decades, we're certainly starting to see more of these extreme temperatures.
So, Lisa, you chair a World Meteorological Organization special team on climate risk. Does the WMO have special monitoring for extreme heat events?
Yes, they do, but obviously National Weather Services themselves, who sit under the WMO, monitor the weather and climate continuously, and that, of course, includes monitoring extreme events. So every country will have something in place for this monitoring, but WMO on top of that does have special task teams and special expert groups which do help with that monitoring, and they try and help especially developing countries help to prepare for those monitoring services.
So the drought extended to Vietnam, which is a major rice exporting nation normally. I'm wondering, could this kind of heat develop into crop loss in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, well, crops are definitely detrimentally affected by excess heat. And in fact, you know, certain crops just can't grow or will die if temperatures exceed very high thresholds. That's very crop dependent, however, so obviously the temperatures for rice will be very different from the temperatures for wheat, will be very different from the temperatures for soy. So basically, while there could be widespread crop loss, I mean, there are lots of different factors which could affect that.
Now, as Australians know too well, heat deaths increase when nighttime temperatures don't cool off enough. Why is that?
Well, I mean, your body needs a rest, and especially if it's exposed to very high temperatures. I mean, we have a physiological response to temperature. And basically, once our core body temperature exceeds a certain threshold, and in this case, it's, say, about 40 degrees Celsius, our organs actually begin to fail. And unless we can cool down straight away, you would die, essentially. So even for temperatures below that, and our core body temperatures are normally around the 37 degrees Celsius mark. So once we get above that, I mean, we'll start to experience heat stress and heat stroke and numerous other conditions that will affect our health. So at that point, if we do exceed, you know, our normal core body temperature, we do need to have some kind of mechanism to allow our bodies to cool down. Otherwise, we do get to the point where we do get into very serious health issues.
And it also seems that humans can take a day or two of extreme heat, but adding just one or two more days can create a public health emergency. Is that a function of the way society works, do you think, or is it based on human physiology?
Yeah, well, as I said before, definitely there is a physiological response here. And if we don't have the capacity to let our bodies rest and cool down, then obviously we can if we keep adding an extra day of excess heat. And especially if we don't get the ability to cool down at night, then it does definitely cause a public health emergency, as you said.
And do you have ideas on what governments or NGOs in developing countries could do to help their populations survive extreme heat?
Obviously, one thing is better forecasting of these events. And actually, I think, to be fair, that the National Weather Services in most countries do a very good job of that. But obviously, actually, the forecast in itself is not the be-all and end-all. And actually, even if you have a good forecast, you then have to put measures in place to actually be able to prepare and respond to that forecast. So definitely, as well as better forecasting, we need better preparation and various measures put in place, especially to look after the people who are most vulnerable to this extreme heat, and that would be the extremely young and the extremely old.
I've been looking into a new study, Lisa, published in the journal Climatic Change. The title is Benefits of Mitigation for Future Heat Extremes. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, that's the Tibaldi and Wehner paper.
Yes.
From Climatic Change. Yes, I am. So that paper, it's really telling us that very extreme temperatures scale with the strength of our emissions. And that is essentially that the more fossil fuels we burn, the hottest temperature is going to be. So it seems that if we only consider mitigation and not adaptation measures, then we could reduce those most extreme hot days by reducing the amount of greenhouse gas accumulation in the atmosphere.
Do you know what sort of heat we can expect if the world continues to depend mainly on fossil fuels well past 2050?
Well, we can certainly continue to expect the sorts of temperatures that we've seen, and you know what we might call extreme today could essentially become the norm in the future. So, I mean, this is obviously quite worrying when we're getting by 2050 in a lot of locations what we consider extreme to be the sort of everyday types of temperatures that we might expect in summer, for example. So we really have to prepare for those kinds of temperatures in the future if we do nothing at this point in terms of curbing our greenhouse gas emissions.
You know, it's interesting. I looked at a survey of media coverage about this Indian heat wave, and apparently very few Western sources, including the BBC or CNN, mentioned climate change at all. Indian newspapers did. Indian politicians talked about the climate connection. What happened in Australia, or did this Indian heat wave even make much of an impact on Australian media?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I've seen quite a lot of media about it, but then I'm obviously interested in heat waves and in general. So I would say it didn't make the top story, but certainly, as I said before, I mean, in India at this time of year, I mean, these are the sorts of, you know, you do have to expect that you would get very high temperatures. So perhaps it hasn't really come into the Western media for that reason. But as I said earlier, we are warming the climate, and we can expect that the temperatures we're seeing in India, while we would expect them to be high, are probably being made even higher by human influence.
Lisa Alexander, what sort of work do you do?
Well, primarily these days, so mostly I'm a researcher and a lecturer at a university, and I look primarily at changes in extreme weather and climate events, and that includes things like heat waves, heavy rainfall, and sort of extratropical cyclones. So I basically try and understand how these events have varied in the past, and I try and look at how these events might be affected in the future under various scenarios of how we might affect the climate.
And does the data support the idea that we're getting more extreme events, or is it just better reporting?
Well, I'm sure the reporting is much better these days, but definitely the data do support that we are getting more extreme temperatures. And actually, in India, for example, which is the place we've been talking about, we have seen very significant increasing trends in the frequency of heat waves that we've seen over the last 60 years or so over India. Actually, not so much in the intensity of the heat waves, so like the hottest temperature of the heat waves, we haven't seen much of a trend there, but we have seen a lot of change in the frequency. So the data do support increases in extreme temperatures in most regions of the world. Actually, one region where the temperatures actually aren't getting warmer is in the southeast US, and we call that the warming hole. So there's basically a few places in the world where we're not seeing extreme temperatures increasing, but on the whole, pretty much everywhere apart from a few locations, we are seeing warming.
As we wrap up here, is there anything that I've missed or something else that you would like to tell our listeners?
I mean, I guess just very simply, we are seeing increases in temperature extremes across most places in the planet. And we can't explain the changes that we've seen unless we include increases in greenhouse gases from human activity. And if we do nothing now, those temperature extremes will continue to rise. So, you know, I guess that's the sort of simple message that I would like your listeners to take away.
It's really going to be a less pleasant world if we let this go.
Honestly, I think so, yes.
Yeah. We've been speaking with climate and weather expert Dr. Lisa Alexander. She's a senior researcher at the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, Australia. Lisa also participates widely in international groups dealing with extreme weather under climate change. Thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Behind the scenes of Radio EcoShock, links to last week's program on the Indian and Pakistani heat waves were tweeted to over 100,000 people in 3 days. That's because we had three high-powered guests. It turns out Berkeley Lab, where we recruited the expertise of Dr. Michael Wehner, has over 40,000 Twitter followers. So does the Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies, where EcoShock guest Adil Najam is the dean. Our scientist from India was just appointed as Secretary of the Ministry of Earth Sciences for the government of India. That's a huge responsibility of care for over 1 billion people. Add it up, and a lot of new people heard about Radio EcoShock last week. The retweets were just as enlightening. Scientists, professors, students, professionals from many walks of life found the show worth sharing with their friends. This week I'm asking you to do the same. If you find this program worthwhile, please tell all your connections through a tweet, a Facebook post, on your blog, or whatever media you use. I think Radio EcoShock has a role to play by getting the research and expertise directly from the sources straight to you. If you know how to use social media, please share Radio EcoShock widely. It may not be popular with everyone, but sooner or later, flood by fire, by storms and by heat, by invasion of the seas and tropical bugs, everyone will need to understand what we cover on this program every week. Thank you for letting me be useful, for giving me the chance to help us all learn, feel, and be together. I'm Alex Smith. Please join us again next week as we explore this changing world on Radio EcoShock. Tracking the climate challenge, Radio EcoShock at ecoshock.org. And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. If you hear marching music, I think there's a great sporting event taking place somewhere nearby. And we're all in favor of sports. I don't know if I'm in favor of the horse races at the moment. I saw the Preakness, and it really bothered me that they spent an hour or 2 hours, I guess, talking about all these wonderful horses, Exaggerator, and... Heck, I can't even remember the name of the favorite anymore. And that was my horse. Oh, Nyquist. However, I noticed that two horses died that day. And the other media were picking it up. But those who, of course, had the contract to do the race, they weren't too interested in talking about dead horses. But it's kind of sad. One of those beautiful horses won a race, and they took it to the victory stand, and it got its... roses or flowers, and then too bad, died. And then another one went down with broken leg through the rider, and the rider broke his collarbone. And the horse, because it's a leg, the racehorses, that's the end of the line, said, when we're going to do the sporting events, to me, you got to report that's what happened, and you ought to be, if you have the program, you ought to be telling everybody. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll tell you, we're going to be talking today to Zafar Benkash. We want to learn about what went on at this special meeting that a four-star American general went into Syria, of course, without the permission of the sovereign state of Syria, and he held meetings with Turkish guys were there, but Kurdish, some Kurdish leaders, and we want to know who they were and what that meeting was about. Zafar Benkash will be talking to us about it, and we will also talk. This is Victoria Day, I'm told, and so today we want to know how it's being celebrated in Quebec. I understand they have a different name there for that day, and so... we'll be talking to them. We'll also talk to Otis Richmond about his quest to have the recognition of Black Music Month. Apparently, at one point in U.S. history, there was such a thing, but oddly enough, under this current administration, it's not celebrated. We hope also to be talking to Wendy Goldsmith about Women's Boat to Gaza. So, potentially, we have a lot of topics here. And I'll tell you, too, you need to know that on Wednesday at 7 p.m., 612 Markham, Betsatoon, 612 Markham, 7 p.m., the occupation of the American mine narrated by Roger Waters. And that should be quite, I think, a very important event. I know that a lot of people are interested. Roger Waters is a rather brave, prominent musician who's taken a stand on the issue of Palestinian rights. And Wednesday, 7 p.m., occupation of the American mine, Betsatoon, 612 Markham. And we're joined now by Otis Norman Richmond. Are you there, Otis?
You got me. How are you doing today?
Doing good. I reversed your name just for the fun of it. You have three names, as I've often told people, so you could get by in a world. That's very smart. Now, it's Black Music Month coming up in June.
In June, correct.
Now, it once was recognized
has status. So what's your goal?
Back on June, our goal is basically President Obama issued a statement dropping Black Music Month, and today he calls it African American Appreciation Month. And I guess that
without music, slash sans music.
Well, it has nothing to do, but it's basically what it does is it recognizes the music of Africans in America, but Black music is international. Mm-hmm. And when Black Music Month was initiated, it was initiated by the Black Music Association with Kenny Gamble, Ed Wright, and Dana Williams, and they attempted to make Black Music Month international in the sense that Dana Williams has a Puerto Rican background, and, Black Music Month, they put together, the Black Music Association put together Bob Marley and Stevie Wonder two times in order to show, the unity of the music. And at that time, jazz musicians like Max Roach were upset because he didn't feel that, they were giving enough emphasis to jazz. However, it was not just for music in the United States. Mm-hmm. So what President Barack Hussein Obama has done is as nationalized and international music.
Uh-huh.
And he dropped it in with this African American Appreciation Month, whatever he calls it. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get Black Music Month reinitiated.
Mm-hmm. Well, you point out it's recognized in Toronto, it had a status. Am I right?
Yes. Even Rob Ford recognized it. Even Rob Ford.
Well, now that is saying something.
Yeah. even Rob Ford. But June Rollins, David Miller. We took a picture with David Miller. When I say we, the late Milton Blake, Mishi Me, Jay Douglas, and others took a nice shot with the 25th anniversary of Black Music Month with Mayor David Miller, and the photograph was taken by one of my next door neighbors, Ray Williams, who is a Grammy Award winning Ray Williams. But that you can do a Google search and look for that photograph. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I just wanted to say that you and your work are found of various places on the net. Is that picture available? I'd like to see that picture.
Yes, it is. It's available. Yes.
So
it's definitely available.
I mean, if like now in this campaign, this is a good time to ask you where you would like people to sign a petition. I guess on the net. All this magic stuff we do on the net. Tell us about that and where they can do it. But also, I just put in a. I hope you post up that picture together with that.
I think I'll do that right now.
All right. So where do people go to find the petition?
It's at change.org. You can go to www.change.org, and the petition is Barack Obama. I want President Obama to bring back Black Music Month.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can just Google my name, Norman Otis Richmond, and Black Music Month, and hopefully I know that will come up.
Uh-huh.
But I will definitely put that up. Post it up as soon as we get off the phone.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned, did I hear the name right? Max Roach fought for this. Is that right?
Oh yeah, Max Roach was a great drummer who was a contemporary of Charles Parker and a freedom fighter. I mean, he did an album called We Insist Freedom Now Sweet, and his music was banned in South Africa. And he was a very stand up guy on the question of African people. He was he did a piece called Garvey's Ghost, one of the, a piece on Marcus Garvey. And he, along with people like Sonny Rollins, he was a firm Paul Robeson man. I mean, Paul Robeson.
That's a big dividing line, isn't it?
Yeah. Paul Robeson was many musicians like Max Roach, Randy Weston, Melba Liston, people that are the same age as my father.
Mm-hmm.
My father would have been 91 years old, or 90 or 91 years old. That generation, their man was Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say, because not all people, but I mean, Paul Robeson was such a stand-up person. You know, a lot of those musicians loved Paul Robeson, and Max was one of the people that followed Paul Robeson
Suppose they understood that because he stood up, he kept the door open for other people.
Yes, he did.
That's how it's done. You know, people get on their case, but it's the guys who are stubborn who make it possible for others.
And he was the one that inspired. They say if you walk into Harry Belafonte's home, I've never done that, but if you walk into his home, the first thing you see is a portrait of Paul Robeson, you know. And Dr. King was a Paul Robeson person, as well as Malcolm X, you know. Yeah. I mean, Paul Robeson, and then I guess you should say that Paul Robeson probably was the, until recently, probably was the best known black person in the world, I guess, until, like, you know, Bob Marley.
Yeah.
Especially in the socialist bloc.
Yes.
Not so much in the capitalist bloc, because he was demonized by the, you know, the in the free world he was a bad guy, but in the socialist countries he was was next to God.
Yeah. I remember you and I spoke on this program sometime back, and I think I read a text from Harry Belafonte talking about how he had to make a decision during the McCarthy times, and he took a job that was, you know, kind of, it was hard to decide whether he should do it. They were trying, and they were putting a lot of pressure on him about his politics, and he said he went to Robeson for advice, and it was very smart advice. He wasn't giving anybody away, any names or anything, but he kept his mouth shut about some of the things he had done or believed, and he asked Robeson, "Is that okay?" And Robeson said, "A black artist in this country, I'm not going to argue with his doing whatever he has to do to get work.
Make a living."
Yeah.
Make a living, right.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. So, Otis, where can people reach to follow you? Now, what's the best thing to do?
Well, I have a blog spot. You can go just type in Norman Otis Richmond and, you know, Google search that, and you can find – I have a blog spot. I'm also on Uhuru Radio. I'm on every Sunday at 2 p.m. And I also write for the Bernie Spear newspaper. Uh-huh. I also write for the Black Agenda Report and the Pan-African Newswire. And the Bayview, San Francisco, Radcliffe has been printing a lot of my stuff in the San Francisco Bayview.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And again, I really wish you well on the Black Music Month, which is June. Maybe we could talk to you again then. I'd like to hear how it's going. And also, we need to revisit this whole subject because you sketched it out very nicely that there the problem in the outlook, the way that President Obama treated it, is to localize black culture and not make it international, right?
And what he did was, I think the first year he did that, he invited Paul McCartney to the White House, and you know, Paul McCartney, you know, I have no argument with the First Lady, but I mean, he, instead of doing Black Music Month, he invited Paul McCartney, and you know, Paul McCartney
is not a very well known black singer.
Of course, he sang Michelle, and of course that's
yes.
You know, so
that's not the right direction to go.
yeah.
Well, Norman Otis Richmond, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you.
I really appreciate you inviting me on the show, and thank you for all your support.
Sure thing. All right.
Thank you.
Bye bye. That's Norman Otis Richmond, and that's go on. Make sure you do it. If Max Roach says it should be done, we should get with it. And particularly with the tie-in to Paul Robeson, I like all that. You're listening to The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I mentioned already, but I'll say it again, that on Wednesday at 7 p.m., The Occupation of the American Mind, narrated by Roger Waters, will be at Betsatoon, 612 Markham. I want to mark a couple things here just to say. Clovis Massoud has died, and Clovis Massoud may be kind of a distant name to many, but he was one of the great intellectuals of, and an advocate of, if I think I have it right, of Arab nationalism, pan-Arabism. And his writings, his lectures, his interviews are all in education. I remember when the first ugliness started with Libya, when Ronald Reagan sent warplanes to bomb Tripoli and ended up killing the stepdaughter of Gaddafi, and how the White House laughed and said, "Oh, we didn't know he had a stepdaughter," after they'd killed her. This is, by the way, this is a 9-year-old child, is my memory. And I saw Clovis Massoud being interviewed, and Clovis was asked what the U.S. The U.S. said that they'd had some little problem with in the. They said they were sailing a warship in international waters, and what about that? And near Libya, and Clovis said, if you go into that Gulf, the only destination of your ship, if you're in that Gulf, would be a Libyan port, and it's a U.S. warship not welcome. And he said, so them for them to talk about, oh, they're just sailing, you know. He said, you can only be going to one place, and so. I liked the way he argued. I liked the way he made his point. And he made an interesting point on the issue of the West Bank, which is talked about a little more and more frequently in Canada, even though it's largely prohibited. But at any rate, he says he objects to you can find this online, by the way. His name is Clovis Massoud. About 3 or 4 years ago, he lived to be, I think he was 91. And he was attending a memorial for a Palestinian poet, and he said, I want to say over and over that the word occupation is not accurate. He said, if an army is in a country which they've conquered, that would be an occupation. But if you start building houses and farms and setting up an economy, that's conquest, and that's what it is. He said, this is a... that's what we're facing is conquest. It is not occupation. And so I really recommend, I think we should all mark the passing of Clovis Massoud. And the best way to do it is go, just put his name, and I bet you can spell it, Clovis Massoud, and then read what he had to say and listen and watch his interviews. And you will come away a more educated and civilized person, I promise.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website MondoWeiss.net, who discusses the significance of hard-right extremist Avigdor Lieberman being appointed Israel's new defense minister. Kim Frochak, an organizer with Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project, who talks about the recent success of campaigns to stop frack gas pipelines. And Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, who assesses the opportunities opened up by Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign for America's progressive movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the midst of the refugee crises in Syria, Iraq, and South Sudan, German Chancellor Angela Merkel was the only Western leader to attend the United Nations' first World Humanitarian Summit in Istanbul, Turkey. The summit, which took place May 23rd and 24th, was organized by outgoing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in order to focus on 125 million people across the globe desperately in need of humanitarian aid. Expectations for the summit were lowered dramatically after the group Doctors Without Borders pulled out of the summit, declaring that the meeting was a fig leaf of good intentions, and that delegates from 175 nations We're ignoring tough issues such as enforcing humanitarian law and protecting aid workers from a growing number of attacks. Oxfam's Mark Goldring told the Guardian newspaper, "Rich nations cannot wash their hands of the suffering for which they are partly responsible." Many aid groups are critical of the recent European Union-Turkey agreement on the migrant crisis and the plan to outsource EU border enforcement to troops from African nations with dubious human rights records. There was no breakthrough at the summit, and the system of international aid remains largely as it has been for decades. In the words of many observers, a system that's unsustainable. Former Austrian Green Party leader Alexander Van der Bellen won the Austrian presidential election by a razor-thin margin over Norbert Hofer, the leader of the far-right anti-Muslim Freedom Party. Hofer led narrowly after 4.6 million ballots were counted, but Van der Bellen, a child of World War II refugees, prevailed after postal ballots from overseas were counted. Hofer, a 45-year-old local councillor, ran an insurgent anti-European Union campaign for the largely ceremonial presidential post. The anti-immigrant Freedom Party won the first round of the election, knocking out both establishment parties, the Social Democrats and the Conservative People's Party. During the campaign, the smooth-talking Hofer appealed to Austrian nationalism, declaring that Islam has no place in Austria. The winning Green Party-backed campaign of Van der Bellen, a retired economics professor, ran on a pro-European platform which embraced refugees. In November, voters in Missouri will decide the fate of a constitutional amendment mandating that voters show a voter ID at the polls. The measure was pushed through by the Republican-controlled state legislature after a 10-year battle. A previous voter ID law was struck down in 2006 by the Missouri Supreme Court, which deemed it to be a violation of a citizen's right to vote. Republicans pushed for a voter identification requirement over the opposition of Democratic Governor Jay Nixon. The constitutional amendment, if approved, could disenfranchise an estimated 220,000 voters who lack a state-issued ID. Democrats, however, did win a few concessions in the legislative debate, including the right of voters to sign a ballot affidavit if they don't have a photo ID. To prevail in November, voting rights activists must overcome the perception that everybody has an ID. In racially divided Missouri, the state Republican Party condemned efforts to register black voters in Ferguson in the aftermath of the police shooting of Michael Brown. Former state Senator Jeff Smith told The Nation magazine, "Missouri Republicans have been really good at equating all things Democratic with all things urban and all things urban with all things black." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to appoint a hard-right extremist politician as his nation's new defense minister has alarmed those working for Middle East peace around the world. Avigdor Lieberman, the founder of the ultra-nationalist Yisrael Beitenu Party, was named to the post in order to add five new seats to Netanyahu's Likud Party governing coalition, which previously held only a one-seat majority in the 120-seat Israeli parliament, or Knesset. Lieberman is well known for his racist and incendiary remarks made during his previous posts in government. Some of his most controversial comments include his advocating the beheading of Israeli Arabs, who he deems as disloyal to the State of Israel, the mass deportation of Arab-Israeli citizens, the drowning of Palestinian prisoners, and the bombing of Egypt's Aswan Dam. Lieberman replaces Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon, who, when he resigned, warned that Netanyahu's government had been taken over by extremist and dangerous elements, and stated that he no longer had faith in the Israeli prime minister. The Palestinian Authority reacted to the appointment by saying, quote, "The Israeli government sent a message to the world that Israel prefers extremism, dedication to the occupation, and settlements over peace." Your reporter spoke with Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website, MondoWeiss.net, who discusses the significance of Lieberman's appointment as defense minister and recent moves by Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign to try to change the Democratic Party platform on the issues of Israel and Palestine.
Well, it's a huge development in Israeli politics, and arguably this is sort of the most important political shift inside leadership culture, ruling class of Israel in the last 20, 25 years, in which the last defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, quit, a pretty right-wing guy, quit the coalition saying that there were fascist trends in Israel and in the political class, and was replaced by this right-wing figure, even further right-wing figure, Avigdor Lieberman, who has threatened to blow up the Aswan Dam, who has said that any Palestinian who attempts an act of terror should have his head cut off, that kind of stuff. So he's a very crude and somewhat at times fascistic leader, Lieberman, and you have this other segment of the Israeli political class saying that the currents there are reminiscent of Nazi Germany, one said. So it's kind of staggering that this is happening. And you have also Israeli political observers speaking of this in apocalyptic tones, and some suggesting that there could even be a coup in the country against Netanyahu.
Philip, what's been the response to Benjamin Netanyahu's appointment of Avigdor Lieberman to become Israel's defense minister? What kind of ripples have moved across the world because of this appointment?
On the one hand, there's been some horror over it. Lieberman is a guy who has been refused admission at the State Department last year. They didn't want him coming in because he was too polarizing a figure, who had said things like the two-state solution, we want nothing to do with it, you know, we're finished with that. The political class in the United States is obviously very upset about this, but they've indicated that the special relationship between the countries will continue. You know, they're still our closest ally and all the rest in the Middle East. But among lovers, defenders of Israel, there has been a real crisis. The crisis that I talk about in the political class in Israel is reflected by a crisis in the Israel lobby in the United States. So these people who spend their lives defending Israel have been in a lot of pain lately. How do they justify this? How do they explain this to Americans? And how do they act as if Israel is fine? And some of them have been saying, this is shocking and horrifying, and we need to give the society a wake-up call, I guess. And others have said, no, everything's fine. This is Israel is a vibrant democracy, robust debate. This is just what happens over there. People disagree, that kind of stuff. So we are seeing a crisis. If you have any hope about this society reforming itself in a bloodless fashion, then you have to hope that the defense minister's resignation and the warnings about fascism could result in some real shift in the political choices of the leadership or a segment of the leadership of Israeli society.
Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, running for the Democratic Party nomination, had an opportunity to appoint five members to a Democratic Party platform writing committee. He appointed some very well-known progressive activists that included Bill McKibben, the climate change activist, founder of 350.org, Native American activist Deborah Parker, progressive caucus co-chair, Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota, and James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute. Philip, tell us what the opportunities are and what you hear about the goals of Sanders' representatives on this important platform writing committee in terms of changes to the Democrats' approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Sanders set a depth charge on April 14th in New York when he told Hillary Clinton that Netanyahu is not always right And he is determined through these appointments to put some more even-handed policy toward Palestinians inside the Democratic platform. Will it be a fight? Will the Hillary Clinton people give in on this and then run away from the platform? Who knows? But from my narrow standpoint, you have Keith Ellison, a Muslim, Zogby and Cornel West, who are going to insist on Palestinian human rights, and that is just such a landmark and just a wonderful moment and could suggest a real shift in American political culture, because Sanders has not been defeated for taking the stand. The Democratic base has supported him, and that's key, is that young liberals in America are increasingly sympathetic to Palestinians over Israelis.
That was Philip Weiss, founder and co-editor of the news website, MondoWeiss.net. Find links to more analysis of Avigdor Lieberman's appointment as Israel's new defense minister by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Local residents in communities where frack gas infrastructure is being proposed or under construction have been joining ever more urgently with those fighting climate change, fueled by the extraction and burning of all fossil fuels. Natural gas is composed of methane, which is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide in the near term. These anti-fracking and pipeline campaigns, along with lower fuel prices, have resulted in the cancellation of 20 fossil fuel projects so far this year. In New York State, people have come together to fight Spectra's AIM pipeline project, which stands for Algonquin Incremental Market Project. Pipeline opponents have carried out several direct action protests recently, three in the month of May alone, that resulted in 24 arrests along the pipeline route. Exerting pressure on New York Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, activists won a declaration from both senators asking Spectra to stop the construction of the pipeline until more health and safety studies are conducted. Among other concerns, the AIM pipeline is being built within 100 feet of the aging Indian Point nuclear power plant, raising fears of a potential catastrophic accident. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kim Frochek, an organizer with Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project. Here she talks about the organizing that's been done thus far and how activists can use their example as a model in other fights against fossil fuel projects around the country.
So we had a postcard campaign going for the last few months to try to get Schumer and Gillibrand to make a public call to halt the pipeline and to investigate FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, who approved the project of Spectra Energy. So we were so pleased. So a lot of people's moods were really elevated on Saturday because we had this, you know, piece of information that our senators and our governor and our Department of Environmental Conservation, Public Services, Homeland Security, and Department of Health were all standing with us to say, yes, we call for a halt of the AIM pipeline. Monday, we all showed up at Schumer's office and we said, we thank you for this, but the next step is going to be that you actually have to call out for a halt of the pipeline. Like, we need the next steps of Schumer to actually utilize his power in the Senate to stop the pipeline and to investigate FERC, which is where we've been collaborating with Beyond Extreme Energy, who has been excellent in shining the light on FERC over the last several years and calling out the faulty bureaucracy of FERC and how they function by only making money from specifically the gas industry. And they're really regulated by nobody, so there's no accountability for FERC. They have an incentive to approve pipelines, and that's what we're calling on Senator Schumer, who is one of the most powerful senators in our Senate, to join together with other senators to call out FERC on their behavior against public health and safety.
Kim Frochek, you all carried out an incredibly creative action last week when you set up a recycled 20-foot shipping container that was transformed into a renewable energy home, and you set it up right on the path of the pipeline where they were doing construction.
We halted construction for the entire morning. We were hoping that the halt would go on for several weeks. The people that were the residents inside of this renewable home were supplied with food for 2 weeks, and they had a, you know, gray water system, compostable toilet. They had a green roof, solar power, electricity-creating, generating bicycle inside to charge their devices if they had to get work done, skylights for natural light. It was a beautiful, beautiful home.
So the police arrested the two people inside the container pretty quickly by cutting a hole into it and pulling them out.
It was actually very symbolic of the, you know, police department working in collusion with FERC and Spectre Energy against the will of the community and against the solutions. So watching them haul off this beautiful, recycled, renewable-powered home in order to continue the construction of the Spectre pipeline was very devastating, very heartbreaking, very symbolic. So we're hoping to basically build popular consensus where we're watching, you know, FERC and Spectre Energy basically shun our state government. They have said, Governor Cuomo has said, please halt the Spectre pipeline so we can do an independent risk assessment since Indian Point nuclear facility is leaking tritium as we speak. The pipeline right next to that is very, very dangerous, and we need to see, you know, where would this might go wrong. And FERC and Spectre both said, nope, we're going to continue. And now Senator Schumer and Gillibrand have come out and said, please halt this pipeline so we can really investigate. This is really putting the safety of 20 million people in the 50-mile radius of this pipeline at risk. This is a democracy issue. This is a property rights issue. This is a water issue. This is an air issue.
I know that FERC was found to have illegally divided another pipeline project into segments and then approved each part. But hasn't Spectre done the same thing here?
What Spectre Energy has done is they've illegally segmented the Algonquin Incremental Market pipeline into three separate projects so that they don't have to do a cumulative impacts statement or study. And FERC has given them the green light to illegally segment this project. So the AIM is the first part of the project, which is going through Westchester County right now. And the Atlantic Bridge will be the next part of the project that will be going from New York into Connecticut. And then the third part of the project will be Access Northeast that will take this up into Massachusetts and beyond, specifically to export this to international markets that will pay 6 to 10 times more than the American market.
What's your next step?
This is a problem for our entire nation. And if we can really turn the Spectre AIM pipeline into the example of our local law taking back their power and shutting this pipeline down, I think we'll be in really good shape in order to copy and paste that tactic across the nation.
That was Kim Frochek of Resist AIM and co-director of the Sane Energy Project. Find links to more information on the group's campaigning against frack gas pipelines and related fossil fuel projects by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the days before Bernie Sanders launched his campaign to compete for the Democratic Party presidential nomination, mainstream journalists and pundits gave the independent Vermont senator's efforts very little chance of succeeding. They said his self-described Democratic Socialist agenda was out of step with most Democrats and America. There were many on the left who also believed that Sanders' decision to run as a Democrat was misguided, given the belief among many progressive activists that the Democratic Party was a captive of special interests like Wall Street and Big Pharma. In a column titled Bernie Sanders' Phantom Movement, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges declared, "The Democrats, like the Republicans, have no interest in genuine reform. They are wedded to corporate power." Despite the enormous rallies, passion, and energy that the Sanders campaign has unleashed across the country, especially among young people, it appears that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is on her way to win the Democratic Party nomination. With that reality sinking in, many longtime progressive activists are asking, what's the future of the Sanders movement? To answer that question, many Bernie supporters will be attending the People's Summit meeting in Chicago, June 17th through the 19th. Others, like Socialist Seattle City Council member Shama Sawant, initiated a petition calling on Bernie Sanders to run as an independent presidential candidate, possibly with the Green Party. The question of what's ahead for the hundreds of thousands of people who joined Bernie's campaign for a political revolution was discussed at the Left Forum conference in New York City on May 21st. There, a group of activists, including Socialist Alternative Party member Shama Sawant, exchanged their ideas in a panel titled, What's Next for the Movement Behind Bernie? Here we present an excerpt of a talk by Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, one of the sponsors of the Chicago People's Summit meeting.
I just want to take us back a year. A year wasn't so far ago. A few little vignettes. One was a meeting of what we might call the non-democratic party electoral left in Chicago, which I think was May a year ago. I wasn't there. You might correct me. At this meeting, a lot of folks got together and essentially, you know, declared a commitment to fighting for more candidates like Shama Sawant, who would run and win outside the two-party system in advanced left causes. A lot of these folks were really angry at Bernie Sanders for running as a Democrat, and many of them have signed a letter, which will live in infamy, explaining to him why he was wrong to run as a Democrat. Now, given last night, where 90% of the folks at the plenary acknowledged that they were voting for him, it seems kind of crazy to look back and see how so many of those folks didn't see the writing on the wall, that running inside the Democratic Party is precisely what got Bernie so much advantage, and it's how we got socialism to be the topic at dinner tables, large and small, across the country in every demographic. That's a huge victory. So the second thing I remember is this feeling that was taking place in May and June, you know, like Bernie Sanders pretending to be a socialist and a leftist when he's really just a, you know, a moderate European or something like that. One person expressed himself and said that a vote for Bernie Sanders means you have blood on your hands because his position on the Middle East isn't quite as pure as this gentleman's. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this is the United States. This is the heart of the global empire. A mainstream European politics would be a massive improvement. How can we get there as fast as possible? And yet, at the same time, his race, his near victory, is demonstrating the limits of mainstream politics in the Democratic Party. It is a fact that the establishment lined up for Hillary Clinton. It is a fact that they used the DNC or the Nevada State Party chair or whatever methods and shenanigans they could to try and tilt the balance, and he's still doing better than 40%. What that shows is not how stupid it is to fight the establishment. It's how weak the establishment is. Just imagine if we could create more battles of this scale and in state levels and district levels and city council levels where we could show again and again how weak the establishment actually is. There's such a large population in the country that has decided with their feet, with their votes, that they are going to show up for a truly radical revolutionary agenda. And they're doing it from all walks of life. One of the problems with these people is they're not quite as politically pure and experienced as we are, which causes, you know, it causes all kinds of problems. They don't know the right lingo, intersectionality. Sometimes they do things they shouldn't, like act as if they might throw a chair. Of course, they didn't throw a chair. We got to work on that. This is a huge movement. Millions of people are basically saying, okay, we're here. Now what? So we have a choice. We can either tell these people how they're doing it wrong, who they ought to join, right, what the ideas are that we would like to pour into their brains, or we can do what an organizer does. Be one with them. Figure out what these grassroots leaderships need from us. Are they building organizations? Are they collecting dues? Are they founding new groups that could use our support? Are they running candidates we've never heard of before? Do they need technical help? Do they need money for us to fundraise? Do they need us to pay a little bit less attention to what we're already doing and a little bit more to what they're doing, even if it's new and imperfect? So along those lines, I would say for after this primary is over, for after the general election is over, I would say that those of us who have the most experience, call it status privilege in the left, what we ought to do is take a look around and figure out who are we going to support? Who do we elevate? Who do we lift up? Millennials, people of color, folks from red states, people in communities that don't have a thick web of infrastructure like New York or San Francisco or whatever. That's what we need to do. And I would suggest that one of the most important things we ought to take into consideration is that the decisions being made by these local people, these local leaders, is not going to flow from thought leaders on high down to the grassroots as received wisdom. It ought to flow from the bottom on up.
That was Charles Lechner, co-founder of the group People for Bernie, speaking at a panel discussion at the Left Forum in New York City on May 21st. Learn more about the debate on what's ahead for the Bernie Sanders campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Memorial Day. Governments determine what day becomes a holiday. They declare what they will and won't honor. They close their offices on such days, and an obedient media sets its programming in lockstep. For example, on Memorial Day, war movies prevail, Hollywood's valorization of war. Of course, few movies can capture the terror, the stench, the cacophony of war, which is, after all, legalized mass murder, brutality, and death. But to the young, such movies fill minds with false glory, false patriotism, and raw nationalism. William Tecumseh Sherman, American Civil War general, said at a military academy in 1879, "War is at best barbarism. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell," he said. Memorial Day isn't a day of remembrance. It is a day of forgetting. We forget the horrors of war. We play Hollywood movies. We overeat and get drunk while politicians preen and plan for the next war. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Till it's over, but there is some motion. It means that we are moving closer to, hopefully, some real treatment, not of my symptoms, but of my disease. I thank you all for being there, and freedom is a constant struggle. I love you all. From what used to be Death Row, this is Mumia, your brother.
Bonjour aux membres du Parti communiste français, mes amis de Congrès, Pierre Laurent, secrétaire national, aussi Marie-Georges de Fay et Patrick Lehieric, merci pour ces moments avec vous. Corrigez. La lutte pour la transformation sociale est en cours. Nous sommes sur les pistes du changement. Camarades, allons. From the jailhouse and prison house of nations, America, and I am Mumia Abu-Jamal. Today, on the issue of the Second Amendment, self-defense, and the left, I am in contemplation over an editorial cartoon from that old journal, Harper's Weekly, of October 28, 1876, by A.B. Frost. No, I don't have a library that extensive, nor a computer. It was reprinted in the San Francisco Bayview
and the cartoon wasn't so much clever as it was revelatory, for it could have been drawn today. It showed a tall, rangy, bearded figure holding a smoking pistol in his right hand and a bayonet in his left. Beneath him is the fallen figure of an emaciated black boy clad in rags, clearly dead. This cartoon bears a legend. In bold print, it reads, "Self-Defense." The bearded white man, identified as Southern Chivalry, states,
"If I had to kill you, you would have grown up to rule me."
Think about that. That was the voice of self-defense in America during the age of Reconstruction. Actually, it was a voice of self-defense in white America. Blacks had a decidedly different voice, and what it said is that self-defense is a human right, practiced throughout history, and shown by groups as divergent as the Deacons for Defense, headquartered in Louisiana, but active throughout the South, to the first year of the Black Panther Party, born in Oakland as the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. It was party co-founder Huey P. Newton who, in his 1967 essay, In Defense of Self-Defense, called for the arming of black people to defend themselves from the repression of the state. Men, Huey explained, were not created to obey laws. Laws were created to obey men. Every law throughout American history was designed to disarm black people while arming whites. That tension lies at the heart of any discussion of the Second Amendment, which ostensibly protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. One wonders, what people? Even today, we see that such a constitutional guarantee doesn't extend to black people today. Remember Tamir Rice, that beautiful little boy in Cleveland, killed by cops for possessing a toy gun? An armed black person is a target. An armed white person, a normality. That, my friends, is our reality. Yesterday, 1876, 1966, 2006, and 2015. The right to arms is as speculative as the right to self-defense. I thank you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Is transition away from fossil fuels toward a renewable global economy based on hydropower, solar, and wind power feasible? How could free trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP compromise Canada's energy security? Does the very existence of the U.S. military-industrial complex and imperialism put to rest any hope of preventing or mitigating climate collapse? Does the prospect of near-term human extinction due to climate change make resistance futile? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we speak to two eminent energy experts and book authors, Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute and Gordon Laxer, founder and former director of the Parklands Institute, about practical strategies for addressing the twin crises of peak oil and climate change. We then hear back from evolutionary biologist Guy McPherson about responses in the faces of an unavoidable calamity facing humanity. On this week's program, Peak Oil and Climate Collapse. Can society make the transition in time? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 3rd, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The objective of the coup d'etat was to deny Brazil's sovereignty in the formulation of macroeconomic policy to hunt its quote-unquote independence. Under Dilma, the tradition of selecting a Wall Street fox had been abandoned with the appointment of Alexandre Antonio Tombini, a career government official who headed the Central Bank of Brazil from 2011 to May 2016. Upon Michel Temer's accession as interim president, Henrique Campos de Meirel was appointed to head the Ministry of Finance. In turn, Meirel appointed his own cronies to head the Central Bank and the Banco do Brasil. Meirel was described by the U.S. media as, quote-unquote, market-friendly. That comes from the article Wall Street Behind Brazil Coup d'Etat by Professor Michel Chosadovsky, posted June 1st. One can surely argue that the Obama administration on the whole was less bad than the previous Bush-Cheney administration, both domestically and internationally. However, because elected presidential candidate Barack Obama arrived at the White House without any administrative experience and without having his own brain trust and seemingly without having a clear plan on how to implement his lofty promises, he had to submit himself to the same neocon advisors and warmongering interventionists who were omnipresent in the previous administration. He ended up reacting rather than acting, following rather than leading. That is why the Obama administration's policies, especially foreign policy, with a few notable exceptions, did not diverge appreciably from those imperial policies pursued by the previous Bush-Cheney administrations. President Barack Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, has failed to live up to the promises he made and the hopes he raised. That comes from the article, Barack Obama's Meager Legacy, Incomplete Accomplishments and Provoked Wars, What Happened, by Professor Roderick Tremblay, posted June 1st. The reason that the CIA began torturing prisoners is that the CIA's leadership was obsessed with the idea that al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden would launch another attack against the United States. Bin Laden said this attack would come, and the CIA's leadership was ready to do anything to stop it. As a result, the CIA began a torture program to try to collect that information. They also created a system of secret prisons, and most prisoners eventually were sent to Guantanamo. That was an excerpt from an interview with John Kiriakou by Edu Montesanti under the headline, an ex-CIA agent, blows the whistle on torture and secret prisons, posted June 2nd. Israel Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan has dipped into the discourse of censorship to convince others that limiting various social media platforms on a global scale is the way to go. In January, he revealed the inner ambition of Israel's security establishment to internationalize the censorship effort. To achieve that goal, Erdan speaks of an international coalition that would make limiting criticism of Israel its primary objective. The central aim is hardly imaginative, making such providers as YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook face up to responsibility as to what they host on their sites. The Erdan plan suggests that various countries would form a, quote, loose coalition that would keep an eye on content and where it is being posted, and members of the coalition would work to demand that the platforms remove the content that was posted in any of their countries at the request of members, unquote. That comes from the article Dreams of Control, Israel, Global Censorship, and the Internet by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted June 2nd. In its annual report on the state of Black America, one of the oldest research organizations in the African American community documents the continuing levels of national oppression and economic exploitation. This report for 2016 represents the 40th anniversary of the yearly study, with the first issued in 1976, released under the title Locked Out: Education, Jobs, and Justice, A Message to the Next President. The document provides more than enough evidence to suggest that the African American people remain an oppressed nation within the political and economic clutches of Washington and Wall Street. Despite the advent of the first African American president in the personage of Barack Hussein Obama, the fundamental problems facing this population of at least 45 million are still unresolved some 151 years since the abolition of chattel slavery and the conclusion of the Civil War. That comes from the article State of Black America. National Urban League report says African Americans remain locked out by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted June 2nd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Climate collapse and peak oil and gas are the two horns of human civilization's global energy dilemma. There are now daunting signs that increasing concentrations of CO2 in the Earth's atmosphere is generating droughts, wildfires, acidification of our oceans, and a rapid die-off of species. Meanwhile, it is now well established that conventional oil production peaked back in 2005, and for the last decade, environmentally destructive techniques like hydraulic fracturing and the mining of bitumen sands and shale oil has exploded the generation of a temporary glut on the market. Dependence on these finite fuels presents humanity with a challenge no politician or community member can afford to ignore. The question is, how can one rationally respond? Transition would seem to be the way to go, but is it feasible and workable? Is it enough to avert disaster? And what would it look like? Joining me to address these questions are two eminent energy experts. Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, a journalist and author of a dozen books, including The Party's Over, Oil, Water, and the Fate of Industrial Societies, and his most recent, Afterburns, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. Heinberg is considered one of the world's leading educators on the subject of peak oil, the opposite side of the fossil fuel energy coin. He's also an avid amateur violinist, and he joins us from California. And joining us here in the CKUW studio is Gordon Laxer, political economist and former head and founding director of the Parkland Institute based at the University of Alberta, where he is professor emeritus. He's widely published in newspapers and magazines and the author of several books, including Open for Business, The Roots of Foreign Ownership in Canada, and his most recent, After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians. So, Professor Laxer and Mr. Heinberg, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Okay, so On the topic of this, the concept of renewable, the renewable economy, I know that there's a Stanford University professor named Mark Jacobson who's written that a 100% renewable economy for the planet built on hydropower, solar, and wind is theoretically achievable by 2030. I know that you know, in your work, Gordon Laxer, you spoke at least with the, within the Canadian context about the feasibility of transition. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about you know, the complications involved in achieving this a renewable economy in that short a time frame.
Well, I think it would be difficult to achieve it by 2030. And I like the term renewable economy rather than just renewable energy, because we're going to have to get there a lot through conservation. We waste so much energy in this country. Norway and Sweden are equally cold, small populated, big countries. They use way less carbon energy than we do. And so I think that's a huge part of the solution. We also have to think in getting to a renewable economy, we have to think about jobs for those who are involved in the present carbon fuel exporting economy, the Canada's huge part of our economy. So, for example, last year in the Alberta Sands, about 50,000 workers were laid off because the price of oil makes it uneconomic, really, to produce oil there. There were 17 projects canceled in the sands last year, and that was almost half the oil projects canceled in the world. What we should be doing is offering the majority of those workers were construction workers. We should be offering them jobs in the transition. So, you know, constructing high-speed trains, Edmonton to Calgary, or, you know, Windsor, Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City, retrofitting all buildings, building LRT, all of those kinds of things. So that there actually are more jobs in saving a unit of carbon energy than in actually finding it, burning it, and emitting it. And it's very important to talk about that because there will be incredible resistance to the change unless we can offer people an alternative. But, you know, we're going to actually have to consume less stuff. This isn't a sacrifice, though. We have to, you know, present this as something that is positive. You're going to have more free time. This isn't buying more stuff isn't what makes you happier. We're going to have to be talking in that kind of way.
Richard Heinberg, I know that you've pointed out that one way or the other, we're going to have to transition. So what are your thoughts about the feasibility of a global renewable economy and
the complications? Well, actually, I've just co-authored a book on this subject called Our Renewable Future, co-authored with David Fridley, who's a staff scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. And we looked at the prospects for a 100% renewable energy transition, not only in terms of energy supply, but also in terms of the ways we use energy. One of the big hurdles is the fact that wind, solar, and hydro produce electricity, but only about 20% of our energy is consumed in the form of electricity. So that means the other 80%, which is used in transportation, in buildings for heating and air conditioning and so on, well, mostly heating, in industrial processes, we have to find ways to electrify all of that energy usage. And in some cases, there are going to be significant challenges. Just a couple that we identified are cement production. Cement, of course, is the main ingredient in concrete, which is in turn, you know, really the foundation, literally the foundation of modern industrial societies. So we probably could produce cement without fossil fuels. The cement production process is a very high heat process, about 1,500
1,500 degrees Celsius. We could produce those high levels of heat without using fossil fuels, theoretically, but there are no pilot projects, and we have no idea how much it would cost to do it. Another hurdle is the aviation sector. Mark Jacobson proposes using cryogenic hydrogen, super-cooled hydrogen, as a replacement for kerosene jet fuels. Well, again, this is theoretically possible, but we don't have any hydrogen-burning airplanes. They would look entirely different. They would have to be completely re-engineered from the ground up. And would that cryogenic hydrogen be affordable? There are lots of reasons for thinking that it would be actually quite a lot more expensive than current jet fuels. So, again, those are just a couple of examples. As Gordon was saying, it's not just a matter of unplugging the coal power plant and plugging in a solar panel. Really, our whole way of life is going to change as we move to renewable energy. Our whole economy will change.
I know that, well, Gordon, you were just talking just now about some of the resistance, the pushback, and I'm thinking, the role of these entrenched entities, big oil, and we hear about the Koch brothers who are financing climate denialism and getting that out in the public realm. And you've also mentioned things about the trade deals which have been signed, which guarantee that even if you had a country or a community that wanted to preserve transition or whatever, then that just means they're still going to keep exporting to the other country, in the case of NAFTA, exports to the United States. So I'm wondering if you wanted to say a little bit more about that the role of these elite entrenched interests in becoming obstacles to achieving that renewable economy.
Yes. Well, they're called free trade agreements, but basically they're corporate rights agreements. And they're about the right of entry of corporations into whatever country has signed these. New trade deals like the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, will make it much more difficult for governments to regulate the environment and corporations can sue. These are really the wrong way to go. In particular, Canada is in a very peculiar position with NAFTA. There's the Energy Proportionality Clause, which most Canadians have never heard of. But basically, it only really applies to Canada. And it says that Canada, even if we have energy shortages here, we must export the same percentage of energy to the United States as we do now. So that's about 70% of our oil, over half of our natural gas. It doesn't apply to Mexico because Mexico said, no, we're not going to sign that. We give up our sovereignty. So that Mexico has an exemption. It doesn't apply much to the United States either because the United States is still an importer of oil. And even with the shale and fracturing and horizontal drilling revolution, it is still going to be importing oil something like a quarter to a third between now and 2035. And the United States wants to get off importing oil from the Middle East and from Venezuela, so they're going to continue to want to have Canadian oil. The problem with us in terms of the environment is that how can we control our own emissions we have to produce almost an unlimited amount of energy for export. And the fastest growing source of emissions in Canada is actually from the production of oil and gas, most of which is for export. That's actually higher than the emissions that come from transportation in Canada. So, what I'd like to see us do, the Alberta's got a plan to get off coal-fired electricity generation by 2030. I'd like to see Canada, in the same time frame, phase out Alberta sands, they can't be greened, and to phase out carbon fuel exports. We have about the same amount of conventional non-fracked oil in Canada as Canadians consume. We should be transitioning to that. And as that declines, we have to cut oil use at least as quickly.
Yeah. Richard Heinberg, I mean, Professor Laxer is bringing up an important point about, you know, whatever ambitions we might have in terms of, like, within a nation or community, there are these agreements that we're binding, whether it's NAFTA or TPP or the World Trade Organization or whatever, that tie the hands of political leadership. So, I mean, is that something that can be just easily shrugged off?
Well, I think governments can rescind those agreements. If governments can make the agreements, they can rescind them. Whatever the penalties might be, they would certainly be, in the end, a better outcome than continuing with these agreements.
Of course, that also means that you're having to stand up to major, I mean, at least the way the modern countries work, you have these what you call special interests or corporate interests that are going to be using every trick in the book to, you know, you propagandize the population through mainstream media and other messaging, lobbying politicians that would make it difficult.
Of course. But these agreements are inherently unpopular anyway. And I think one of the messages we're seeing from the current U.S. election is that people are really fed up with the globalist agenda. They've seen jobs disappear. They've seen their environment wrecked. And it just doesn't make sense. And here in the U.S., it's been both Democrats and Republicans pushing this agenda for the last several decades. And I think the message of both Donald Trump, regardless of how regardless of the messenger, and also of Bernie Sanders, is, you know, enough is enough.
Mm. Although you mentioned Donald Trump, and as I understand it, Mr. Trump has who has a good chance of becoming the next president, had named Representative Kevin Cramer from North Dakota as his energy advisor, and Cramer is not only a climate skeptic, but one of the leading oil and gas drilling advocates in the United States, from a state that's on the front lines of the U.S. shale oil and gas boom. So, I mean, that suggests that whatever he might say on the campaign trail, that what ends up being executed is going to go very much against what the people think that they're voting for.
Right. Well, the trade deals are somewhat different subject than energy policy, perhaps less so for Canada, because with Canada we're talking about mostly energy exports. But in terms of climate and energy policy, I think you're absolutely right. All of the statements that Trump has made suggest that he doesn't understand energy and certainly doesn't understand climate.
Mm. Well, you mentioned this idea that I think people would like to see that it seems to be an increasing sense in a lot of messaging about the need to move to a renewable economy and to, you know, policies that are, you know, friendly to the climate and moving us, transitioning us. But I don't know if they really necessarily know what they're in for, because, the ways in which our lives would have to be changed. You mentioned about the airplanes, not being able to fly around quite as much. The fact that civilization as we understand it is still heavily dependent on so many things beyond electricity, mining and agriculture. And it appears that it's going to be hard to do a lot of those things without fossil fuels. So in practical terms, what is that going to mean, like, to people's everyday lives? Gordon, do you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I don't think we know exactly how it's going to unfold. We have to we have to first make a commitment to get there and to do it quickly over the next three decades or so. And we have to then set up a framework which is going to get us there. We need a framework which is going to tilt the marketplace in favor of people buying renewables and using conservation rather than carbon fuels. But there has to be a lot of public support. If people are going to get out of their cars, you have to have good transit. You have to have cycling. You have to have walkable suburbs. You have to have densified cities, intercity, high-speed intercity rail. You can't just say, okay, you know, this is an individual decision. People just have to get out of their cars. But there is going to have to be a cultural revolution as well. I mean, I know people who won't even walk a block. They'll get in their car to drive a block. And, you know, it's incredibly unhealthy to be living like that if you're able-bodied. So we also need a cultural shift. We need people to really recognize what we're in. And this is, these kind of discussions that we're having here is, trying to initiate that kind of thing.
Mm. Richard, I mean, for that matter, you mentioned that the amount of the energy required for the formation of concrete. And I'm wondering, because you've in your writing, you've talked about how much our whole way of life has been centered around this reality. Our economy is centered around this idea of all the huge amount of energy we get from oil and natural gas. And, one wonders if even cities as we know it would enter into a kind of a transition. Would people be living more on the land? How do you envision, a post-carbon world beyond the, lack of pollution and whatnot?
Right. Well, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. There's a lot that we can do right now to reduce our use of fossil fuels. I think taking coal out of the electricity mix is something that could be done immediately with the technology that we have, just replacing coal with solar, wind, geothermal, and so on. And we're not talking about going cold turkey immediately. We'll still be using fossil fuels for the foreseeable future. Right now, the way we produce PV solar panels and wind turbines, all of those industrial processes use fossil fuels. So we're going to increasingly have to do a kind of triage where we look at what are the most important societal uses for fossil fuels, whether it's producing renewable energy infrastructure or agriculture or what have you, and dedicating our remaining fossil fuel usage to those purposes and curtailing use of fossil fuels for things that can either be replaced or simply done without. In the process, I think what we really need to do, and this is something that's very hard for policymakers to even think about, much less talk about, is reconsider economic growth. Because as we make this energy transition, it'll be one thing to maintain an economy that supplies people's basic needs. It's something altogether different to imagine that we can continue the scale and the rate of growth that we saw over the last quarter of the 20th century. And, of course, that's what all politicians want to be able to promise to their constituents, that we're going to have an ever-expanding economy, more roads, more cars, cheaper consumer goods, and so on. Realistically, that's just not in the cards. And I would say the same is true even if we don't attempt the energy transition one way or another. The economic growth that we saw in the late 20th century is pretty much over. So the question is, how do we deal with that? And I think being honest about it is a first step. And then the second step has got to be to make a realistic plan to get off of fossil fuels and engineer, design, and build an economy that is truly sustainable.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Now, I suspect that the elites, particularly within the United States, but through much of the world, would have a tough time being convinced because the trajectory so far, as stated by what's called the Carter Doctrine, is the necessity, the strategic importance of oil. And so you have a whole military-industrial complex directed toward control of oil. I think a lot, most of our listeners, at least, are most likely of the view that the Iraq War, for example, was all about oil. And I just happen to have a statistic. This is from the Oil Change International report cited in The Guardian from December of last year. The Iraq War was responsible for 141 million tons of carbon releases in the first 4 years. On an annual basis, this was more than the emissions from 139 countries in this period, or about the same as putting an extra 25 million cars onto U.S. roads for a year. And the paper found that projected U.S. spending on the Iraq War would cover all global investments in renewable energy needed to halt global warming trends in the period to 2030. So are we basically – I mean, does this basically leave us in the position of having no choice but to confront and dismantle the U.S. Department of Defense, the Department of the U.S. military-industrial complex?
Right. Well, you know, in the military itself, there are a lot of people who would prefer not to be engaged in these operations. I think where you see the entrenched interests are among the arms manufacturers, who, of course, are making money hand over fist as these weapons are manufactured and used, and then the foreign policy establishment in Washington, the so-called neoconservatives, who seem to have a grip on power regardless of whether it's a Republican or Democratic administration. These people really are the ones responsible for the belligerent nature of U.S. foreign policy over the last decade and a half, and these folks need to go. I mean, they are really putting us all at risk in terms of their policies, not only in the Middle East, but also with Russia and China. We need a complete about-face in terms of foreign policy in Washington. And, you know, I don't see that happening until there's much more of an upwelling of public outcry about this.
Gordon Laxer, as in a previous interview, you talked about these North American integration initiatives and how energy security for Canada and energy security in the United States are not necessarily one and the same. And so, given the amount of energy that's used, at least you know currently by the U.S. Pentagon, what responsibility would you say we have? Can we do anything to mitigate or challenge the U.S. agenda?
Well, the when Washington talks about official Washington talks about energy security, they often are talking about finding oil under someone else's sands. In Canada, that's because the United States is an empire and is looking for resources elsewhere and to control them. Because Canada is an energy satellite of the United States, when we talk about energy security, we're talking actually energy sovereignty for Canadians. So it's very different, just regaining control of our own resources so that we can use them in a different way and also for Canadians' basic needs. We have to think of access to energy as a basic amount of energy as a human right as we move to a lower energy kind of society. But Canada, you know, Canada can play as a middle power a role in trying to reduce the Western countries' alliance, you know, aggression in other countries. Canada could take a leadership in that and try and make alliances with other countries and also make alliances with the more progressive part of the U.S. Public opinion and political leaders. Canada could play an important role in that. I mean, the bigger job would be within the United States itself, but Canada is not a total bit player.
You know, I see a lot of people, they really do in the end appreciate imperialism. They just don't want to confront it. So, I mean, everybody who carries around one of these smartphones should be thanking exploited coltan miners in the Congo. Is it politically sellable to ask people to, you know, they're going to have to lower their expectations and not consume as much as Richard was explaining earlier. Is that feasible?
Well, it's going to change. It's going to we need a cultural revolution about this. I mean, you know, for most of my life, I've been fighting for more stuff for the poor, making sure that people have necessities. But once people have the basics, you know, you have enough food to eat, you've got shelter, you've got clothing, you've got some amount of leisure time, we don't get happier by buying more and more stuff. We actually get our most of our pleasure from each other and from nature. And so we are going to have to move in that. One of the difficulties is that when there's been a shift away from high-paying jobs, you know, in manufacturing and a number of sectors, and people have been compensated, when people in lower income in Canada and the global north, by buying cheap products from the global south. So they go to Walmart and they save money and they spend less on food than they used to 30, 40 years ago. And this, you know, this is the compensation for them earning lower wages. We're going to have to, you know, move up to the $15 an hour minimum wage, have a livable wage. So there's going to have to be a whole shift. And, you know, we're going to have to move to a more locally provisioned and nationally provisioned economies and producing. And, you know, that every country is going to have to find their own solutions to their energy like they did before the Industrial Revolution. I'm not saying we're going to go back to that way of living, but I think that, you know, I think we're seeing a move away from the global economy.
Okay. Richard, the revolution?
Yeah, I totally agree, and Gordon just made most of the points that I was going to. Localization is in our future one way or another. Globalization was based on the kinds of trade agreements we were talking about earlier, but it was also based on cheap oil for shipping and for truck transport across long distances. As that cheap oil goes away, either as a result of smart climate policies or simply the process of inevitable depletion, one way or another, we are going to see less mobile economies, and that means more localized economies. That doesn't have to be a bad thing. We traded away a lot in terms of human rights and environmental sanity in order to promote globalization of production and trade. And as we move back toward more localized economies, we could see substantial benefits in terms of our you know, tangible way of life, our communities, this knowing who is producing our stuff. And you see that at farmers markets. People really like to engage with one another as producer consumers, rather than just you know, buying something at the Walmart and having this terrible feeling that it was probably produced in ways that you really don't want to know about, but you have no alternative. Moving toward a more localized economy is inevitable. It's just a question of whether we embrace the trend and optimize it or let it overtake us in ways that are far from optimal.
One more point to raise, and I'm just going to quote some rather sobering statistics. This comes from the investigative journalist Dar Jamail, writing one of his weekly climate dispatches in Truth Out. He talks about NASA releasing data showing that the planet has just seen 7 straight months of not just record-breaking, but record-shattering heat. And the NASA data showing that April was the hottest April ever recorded, as well as the fact that it crushed the previous April record by the largest margin of increase ever recorded, making this 3 months in a row the monthly record has been broken, and easily. Also mentions that the Arctic without summer sea ice could happen as early as this September, a turn of events that would have serious implications for global climate patterns, a loss of sea ice, even outpacing the worst case modeling predictions. And also, according to a recent press release from the National Center for Atmospheric Research, a reduction in the amount of dissolved oxygen in the oceans due to abrupt climate disruption is already happening and will become widespread by before 2040. And one more study recently released by the UK-based Christian charity Christian Aid projected over 1 billion people at risk from coastal flooding by 2060, with the populations of China, India, and the United States being the most heavily impacted. So I am just going to ask the two of you a question. Is this too late? You know, the transition, is it too little too late? Have we reached the tipping point? Are we looking at the near-term extinction of our species?
Maybe I'll go first. No one knows how close we are to a irreversible tipping point. I think those who say that near-term extinction is more or less inevitable at this point are exaggerating an interpretation of the data. Very few climate scientists would agree with that assessment. Nevertheless, the trends that you talked about are extremely serious. There's no question about it. We have set in motion some self-reinforcing feedback mechanisms, such as the melting of the Arctic permafrost, especially in Siberia, releasing enormous amounts of methane, much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And that's why we're seeing these extraordinary temperature records being set month after month. That's why we need to take climate very seriously, not only in terms of reducing our fossil fuel usage, but also in terms of changing our agricultural practices so that we're building topsoil rather than destroying it, because by building topsoil, we're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and sequestering it in the safest and most useful place it could possibly go. Reforestation. It's very clear that we could capture and sequester very significant, globally significant amounts of carbon if we took these matters seriously. So it's not just a matter of stopping doing the bad things. We could actually transform our civilization in ways that would prevent the worst of climate change while giving us a safer and healthier food system.
So Gordon Laxer, I mean, this is I know there's a saying that opportunity and catastrophe are kind of like opposite sides of the same coin. What are your thoughts on the subject of our dire future prospects?
Yes, I mean, I lived in Alberta for 31 years. Edmonton is the closest big city to Fort McMurray, where there was this awful wildfires and 90,000 people had to evacuate. These are really climate change refugees. And this kind of thing, it's hard to attribute one fire to global warming, but there are twice as many, the area of forest fires is twice as much as it was in the 1970s, and is predicted to either double or triple in the next 3 or 4 decades if global warming continues in its present path. And it's when you see something like that in China, when you can't breathe in the cities, if these things, disasters actually brought home to people that we have to do something, that's important. But it's also important that, in Canada, I think there's less of the climate denial thing that we see. Maybe it's stronger in the United States. It's still fairly strong in Alberta. But I think we're into a kind of solutions denial. A lot of people, the majority of Canadians actually they say, yes, we have to do something about climate change, but they don't see that there is a solution that's possible. And it's important that we actually start to build roadmaps, to do more work, to get out and talk to people and say, yes, these are feasible roads, and this can be a better future than we have now. It's very important that we do that and to dispel the worries that people have in making that transition. And also, when I talked about jobs, that is one of the more scary things. I mean, people are going to hang on to the job they have rather than some job you promise them that isn't there yet. So we have to really develop a really viable transition policy.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid that we're now out of time, but Gordon Laxer, Richard Heinberg, I've very much enjoyed this discussion, although, you know, for the some of the negative aspects to it. But thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us.
Okay.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Great to be here.
Richard Heinberg, senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute and author of Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels, among other books. And Gordon Laxer is a political economist and the former head and founding director of the Parkland Institute and author of After the Sands, Energy and Ecological Security for Canadians. We're joined now by Guy McPherson. He is the Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He spent years assembling and collating available peer-reviewed research on climate. And on his blog, Nature Bats Last, there is a monster climate essay which leaves readers with the conclusion that there's virtually nothing that can be done to halt runaway climate change and the near-term extinction of the human species. And he joins us from southern New Mexico. Thank you for joining us once again, Guy McPherson.
Thank you for the opportunity, Michael. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, so, you're joining us now. We're talking about responses to the climate, the twin crises of peak oil and gas and climate change. And we'd mentioned the issue of near-term human extinction previously with two previous guests, and you know, one of them has basically said that while he acknowledges there's a lot of concerns, he seems to feel that there's when it comes to near-term human extinction, that there's an exaggeration of an interpretation of the data that very few climate scientists agree with. I wanted to give you an opportunity to express why you believe there is a that the near-term human extinction is very much on the table, in fact, locked in.
Well, we've triggered so many self-reinforcing feedback loops. Or quote, positive feedbacks on the climate front, including firing of the clathrate gun from the Arctic Ocean. So that's methane coming out of the Arctic Ocean into the atmosphere. Methane has gone exponential in the atmosphere, as has carbon dioxide. And then there's the issue of solar dimming or global dimming. If we stop putting particulates up into the atmosphere, particulates other than greenhouse gases, things like aerosols and sulfate from burning low-quality coal. If we stop doing that, all those particulates fall out of the sky in a very short period of time and cause an abrupt rise in temperature. I suspect beyond which the human species can persist, and certainly with the rapidity of that increase in global average temperature, it would be difficult for the other species we depend upon to adapt in time. And that's not even including the self-reinforcing feedback loops. Two of the fast ones include methane from the shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean and moistening of the upper troposphere. As the planet gets hotter, it gets moister too. And most of that moisture ends up in the upper troposphere, more than 90% of it, between 8,000 and 13,000 meters above the surface of the Earth. And as the moisture goes up there, it serves as a greenhouse gas. Water vapor is the most abundant of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And it causes more heating. And more heating means more moisture in the atmosphere, and more moisture in the atmosphere means more heating. So it's a classic self-reinforcing feedback loop. You put together a few of these self-reinforcing feedback loops. Even just the couple that we have predictions about the timing for, and coming to you using even a relatively conservative approach, it's difficult for me to imagine a situation in which we avoid the temperature, 22 degrees Celsius, at which the planet has spent most of its time in the last 2 billion years in the very near future. And I'm not going to put a date on that, but it seems we're headed for 22 degrees Celsius plus or minus a degree based on the fast feedbacks. And so what that means is not decades and certainly not centuries, but rather months or years from now, we could be facing temperatures characterized by the dinosaurs, for example. And it's really, really difficult for me to imagine a situation in which all the other species on the planet are able to keep up with that kind of change. It's far more rapid than the great dying of 252 million years ago, for example, when more than 90% of the species on the planet went extinct.
So in that case, no matter what we do at this point, I mean, when we talk about the renewable economy, I mean, you mentioned about global dimming, and I suppose if we're able to completely wean ourselves off of these fossil fuels, that gets rid of the that deals with the dimming problem in the sense that the dimming disappears at the same time, and then you're dealing with the situation that inviting the collapse even faster. But is there anything else about the renewable economy that you think is maybe misguided or naive?
Well, it essentially allows relatively privileged folks, mostly in the global north, to keep doing what we've been doing that I would argue has not been working for a lot of other species and a lot of other cultures on the planet. So based on a report from the United Nations, August 2010, we're driving an estimated 150 to 200 species to extinction every day, and that's rooted in industrial civilization. We depend upon many of those species for our own continued persistence on the planet, and switching to any other energy sources that allow us to keep doing the same flawed strategy seems like a bad idea to me. And never mind the other consequences of civilization, particularly industrial civilization, including, for example, disparity in wealth, disparity in income, which is, as I understand it, never been greater than it is right now, and the fouling of the air and the dirtying of the water and the washing the soil into the ocean, and, you know, the list goes on. Do we really want to keep doing things the same way and just assuming that the children will adapt? It seems a little short-sighted to me.
Hmm. That being said, though, I mean, even if our we can still make changes. It's just that they may not be like I indicated earlier. Maybe it's just too little, too late. But I mean, you can, for example, I know that you individually have altered your you haven't decided to say, oh, what the heck, and just.
No. I'm a huge fan of taking action, and I have never proposed inaction in response to the myriad predicaments we face. And so it was more than 7 years ago that I left my high-pay, low-work job at the University of Arizona. I was actually banned from teaching in my home department, so I was paid to not show up. And I left that position to establish an off-grid homestead in southern New Mexico. So I use solar panels to provide electricity and also to power the pumps that get the water out of the ground. And so I've never proposed inaction. In fact, I'm the poster child of the kind of person who should not have concluded near-term human extinction as a result of climate change or any other means, because I took this profound action to plan for the twin sides of the fossil fuel coin, peak oil and consequent decline of civilization, and also climate change. So this homestead is the product of a 3-year search for the place to land, And I was keeping in mind relatively slow climate change and also peak oil. And here we are in the midst of abrupt climate change. And we're finding out every day a bunch of information that we weren't privy to seven plus years ago when I left the university, and about 9 years ago when I made the decision.
And over that time, have you have you learned any lessons or possibly had any disappointments or anything else that you might want to share with listeners?
Well, yes, of course, it's very disappointing to give up a position such as the one I had and conclude in retrospect that I could have been working not very hard and making quite a lot of money and probably had a larger voice than I do now on various topics. Many mistakes. In fact, I try to make all my mistakes many times just so I learn from the experience, because they say you learn from your mistakes. I'm not going to go down that road here, but probably the most important thing I've learned is the community, the human community that one finds oneself within is absolutely fundamentally important to one's well-being. So we talk a lot about other characteristics of habitat, such as food and water and the ability to keep our body temperature at a safe level. But I would argue that more important than all of those is the people with whom we spend our time.
Mm. And just, I guess, on a concluding note then, I know you've spoken about the need to face our these twin crises, predicaments, as someone in hospice, as a human species is in hospice. That doesn't necessarily mean that we give up.
Oh, no. No, that's absolutely right. It means living more fully every day. It means accepting the fact that we all get to live, and therefore that we all get to or have to die, depending upon your perspective. And so living with some sense of urgency, I think, is paramount here. And I think that's the case regardless of whether we're knowledgeable about these predicaments or not. Consider, for example, the world's oldest human being turned 117 years old in March of 2015, and in response to the question, what was that like? You know, how would you consider those first 117 years? She said, it seemed rather short. And then to put a punctuation on her message and mine, she died a couple of weeks later. So life is short. We should treat it with urgency.
Okay. Well, I very much appreciate your thoughts, as always, Guy McPherson, and I wish you well down there in the mud hut, and also on your speaking tour. Seems unending these days.
Yes, thank you very much, Michael. It's been quite a ride.
We've been joined by Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Natural Resources and Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Arizona. He is the host of the Nature Bats Last radio program on the Progressive Radio Network. And you can read more of his material at the website guymcpherson.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.